We sent you yesterday.
Let's see what the version. Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this beautiful sunny, what day is it?
It's Wednesday.
Wednesday, the 13th.
The 13th of July? Oh, no. January.
But it is 2016.
Maybe it's not sunny and bright. Anyway, welcome, team. Happy to be back with you again at the same channel. We're going to open an informational meeting, and I'm going to ask the OHA director to join us to talk about what's going on in OHA. Saxon? Here you are.
I'm here.
Yeah. You can't hide. Welcome, guys. You can organize this in whatever way's handy for you.
Thank you, sir. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, the Oregon Health Authority. I'm Lynn Saxton, director of the Oregon Health Authority. We're very pleased and excited to be here to talk to you today about our new One eligibility system. And we're also pleased, and it's my privilege, to introduce Dr. Varsha Shahan, who is the Chief Health Systems Officer for the Oregon Health Authority and has been with us for 5 weeks now. So we're very pleased to have her on board. I do want to just introduce this work, and then I'm going to turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Sarah Miller, who at one point over the Christmas holidays I offered to have a bed delivered to her office because I was convinced that she was sleeping her 4 hours a night at a state office building. So she has done heroic work here, and we are all very excited about it. And then finally, before I turn it over to her, I just want to say that the number one operational priority for the Oregon Health Authority is the eligibility, enrollment, redetermination, closure process and system. We are intensely focused on it. We have assigned a lot of resources to getting it right and to driving to clear and accurate information for you on a regular basis, and we're going to introduce that to you today. Finally, I just want to extend an invitation to our reception for legislators at 4 o'clock tomorrow on Thursday in the Governor's Conference Room. We will have the complete leadership team of the Oregon Health Authority in one place for you to meet, and I think that's really critical because there are many new talented professionals who've joined the Oregon Health Authority in the last 3 weeks, and I'd love to introduce them to you. We will also be sharing Health System Transformation 2.0, our twice-yearly report on the performance of your healthcare system at that convening tomorrow. So we look forward to seeing you there if you're available.
I'd like to encourage you as well. I really encourage Ms. Saxon and her staff to do something like this. It's a new team, and the relationship between that management team and these committees and the legislature, I think, is a very important piece. So I would add that. It would make a lot of sense if you could be there.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. In my daytime job, I'm actually the Chief Operating Officer for Technology for the Department of Human Services. But for the last 15 months, I've been in service to the Oregon Health Authority working on the MAGI Medicaid System Transfer Project. I'm here today to walk you through our progress to date. And because I haven't been in front of this committee, I'm going to tell a little bit of a story that connects a bunch of topics that you've heard about. So the slide that you see in front of you talks about two different kinds of Medicaid. We, as a result of the Affordable Care Act, the federal government changed this Medicaid program so that it created what we call MAGI Medicaid. MAGI is an acronym that stands for Modified Adjusted Gross Income. That's Medicaid benefits that you're eligible for on the basis of your income status. Then all other kinds of Medicaid we called generically non-MAGI Medicaid. And this slide shows you from a caseload perspective what the federal poverty level is that the Oregon Health Authority supports for eligibility for different kinds of Medicaid programs. So our coverage of pregnant women and infants to the age of one, we go up to 185% of the federal poverty level. Children between 0 and 18 qualify for Medicaid if their family has 133% of the federal poverty level, qualify for CHIP between 130%, 33%, and 300%. Parent, caretaker, relative, and ACA adults are expansion programs. The blue bars here are the federal poverty levels associated with non-income-related Medicaid programs. So aged, blind, disabled, and the last column, QMB and SLMB, are Medicaid coverage for what we used to call categorically eligible. So if you're old, you're blind, you're disabled, you have Medicare, dual coverage. That eligibility determination work is actually done by my permanent employer, the Department of Human Services. But OHA is the state's single Medicaid agency. And so this system, in its initial deployment, is in support of MAGI Medicaid eligibility determination. But you will soon hear me be back in front of you in February talking about that DHS wants to leverage this investment for other eligibility programs, including all of the blue bars. And so this just gives you a general overview. It explains to you why it's super complicated, right? Depending on the kind of Medicaid and our funding stream, we have eligibility qualifications at different income levels. And so we needed a system that could accurately capture income and evaluate it based on household composition to decide whether you'd be eligible. The one system does that for income-related Medicaid programs and the children's health insurance. So I think you know the story, right? We took the Kentucky state-based marketplace, which was an Affordable Care Act compliance system that the federal government held up as the best system in the entire country to do Medicaid eligibility determination. We brought that system to Oregon. We specifically said we're going to take what works, we're going to bring it to Oregon, we're not going to break it, we're going to make the fewest technology changes possible to use it in benefit for the Oregon Health Authority. That system in Oregon we call Oregon Eligibility, or ONE for short. Now, what you need to know about Medicaid systems is the system that we use to determine if somebody is eligible for Medicaid is not the system in which we use to enroll them or claims process. So this slide shows you eligibility happens in ONE. We connect that eligibility decision with the existing state Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS for short. And MMIS has relationship with Oregon's coordinated care organizations, right? And so we have interfaces between MMIS and CCOs so that we can pass information about new members or current members and their families all the way to the people who provide them care. And so there are really three systems from a technology perspective that are involved in making sure Oregonians have access to Medicaid. Just a reminder, when we set a foot on this project, which might be the fourth time in Oregon, right, that we tried to do this exercise, for this version, we said our objective was to improve Oregonians' access to healthcare by providing a simplified process for eligibility determination and enrollment in the health plan. What the ONE system does for you that previous incarnations of this project did not is it actually allows a connection between federalhealthcare.gov and our system, which means practically applicants have an experience where they provide information at either door, and we send that information to the other place. So if you come to the OHA front door and we say you're not eligible for Medicaid, or members of your household are not eligible for Medicaid, we'll send the information you've provided us to federalhealthcare.gov, and they'll reach out to you to decide whether you're eligible for tax credit or cost share reductions. And the reverse is true, right? If you have a family and you go in because you see the open enrollment commercial and you go to federalhealthcare.gov and you complete an application, now federalhealthcare.gov says, hey, we think you might be eligible for Medicaid in Oregon, and they send all the information that you've provided at the federal level to us so that we can make an eligibility determination. It's a much better coordination of care scenario for Oregonians. The next bullet is the one that generally gets me a standing ovation when I'm in front of coordinated care organizations, because our old system did not allow us to connect members of a family in a single household. We frequently would have mothers be born, infants be born to mothers, and we couldn't attach the baby to the mama. The one system does, in fact, allow a report of change of a newborn birth that gets attached to the family, and the family construct is maintained. And we are making choices about how we use the one system initially in order to fix this problem in our source system. If I was to take the data from the four source systems that I have and move it in, we would perpetuate this problem. And so as a practical matter, that means Oregonians have to reapply for Medicaid for a 12-month period of time so that they tell us who are the members of their household. If I can't reliably construct the members of the household, I have the potential to determine your eligibility inappropriately because I've missed members. I have the potential of exposing privacy violations that might put you in danger if you're a victim of domestic violence. And so it's very important for us in the continuity of care for Oregonians that they reapply so that we can build the family construct in the way that supports how they're reporting that it works.
Is that going to be continuing? That's going to need to reapply every year?
Only for a 12-month period of time. I have to get the data into the system appropriately, and then as soon as I have it in, you can report a change via self-service. We'll be able to automate renewal, or we'll populate a form that says, here's everything you told us about you last year. Tell us if there's only changes, and then we'll be able to take action on that. So it's a limited period of time to get all of the families constructed appropriately in the new system, about 12 months from February of this year until February of next year, and then that problem won't continue. The system also provides the ability to simplify eligibility workload because we can automate steps in a process. So in portions of the operations that Dr. Shahan and Ms. Saxton are responsible for, we had been requiring manual handoffs. And the system actually has a workflow process that lets us take it through steps and assign tasks for eligibility workers to do. We're able to have centralized, verified enrollment data available for our CCO partners. So one of our partners' big complaints has been they can't rely on the data associated with enrollment from our system. And so this system provides us an opportunity to rectify that. We also, frankly, have not been able to produce reliable metrics to our federal funding partners from an operational perspective. We've been unable to say exactly how many people are enrolled in which program and when did we do it and what action did we take. And this system has actually system-generated statistics that come out as part of required federal performance reporting. And that means it's consistent, right? We don't have to rely on human intervention or ticking little checklists and count to make sure all the numbers get reported appropriately. In the beginning in February of this year, Oregonians will be able to set up an account, just like you create an account for your online bank or you create an account for your airline frequent flyer program. You'll be able to apply, report changes, and receive real-time eligibility determinations. So members of the OHA staff should be delivering large 11 by 17 versions of this picture to your offices this week. I call it my Choose Your Own Adventure. And it's a guide that we put together that allows your staff to ask constituents a particular set of questions, and based on the yes-nos, it directs them to the place where they can best get service. We know that your job is to be in the business of helping constituents figure out how to navigate the crazy that is state government. And so this is a simple tool in a complicated system that allows you to help them go most quickly to where they can best be served. And so you're all getting copies for your office. One of the things we did to control risk in this version of the project was to separate out the implementation into two phases. So on December 15th, I officially turned on the back end of the system, which we call Worker Portal. Like the name might suggest, that's the portion of the system that OHA employees use to do eligibility determination. Now, frankly, because I'm a little bit of a control freak, I did not want to flip the switch on 12/15, so we actually began processing eligibility applications on December 5th and did a series of system readiness verification activities. So frankly, 12/15 came, which happened to be my son's 10th birthday. It came, it went, there was no big reporting of major episodes, and the system works. And so right now, today, we have a team of people at OHA Member Services Center who are processing eligibility applications using the one system. You'll be happy to know notices are coming out of the system in an automated way. That's something that super excites me. We have address validation. So if I'm doing data entry and I make a mistake in the address, the system is smart enough to say, hey, that's not really the address. Don't you mean this other one, right? So if I get the zip code wrong, I spell the county wrong, it checks. So the integrity that the system provides in terms of our ability to provide consistent data to our partners is much better. On February 6th, we will turn on, in a limited way, the applicant portal. So applicant portal is meant to be the consumer front end. It'll be a website where I can sit at home, or my community partner organization can assist me to be able to complete an application for Medicaid. Now, what you need to know because of that little data problem I told you about is on February 6th, if you do not have current Medicaid coverage, you'll be able to go to this website, complete an application. I'm going to verify the information that you provide to me on that application. And if you're eligible, I will determine you real time and enroll you in Medicaid. However, if you're one of the 1.1 million people in the state who have current Medicaid coverage and you come on February 6th, if you have not had your application touched by an OHA worker between 12/5 and February 6th, what'll happen is I'll say Sarah Miller, my date of birth, my Social Security number, and if I have current Medicaid coverage, the system will come back and say, I'm sorry, we know you. You can't use this door. We need you to call the OHA call center so that a worker can help you get the information into the system. And the reason why consumers will have that experience is because in the absence of me being able to construct the family appropriately, I have the potential of showing people information that they shouldn't have access to. So once my family has been constructed appropriately, then I can create an account. I can be attached to that account. I'll prove my existence and with the federal government to say I am who I say I am, and then I'll be able to use the self-service portal to make subsequent changes. If I'm new and Medicaid doesn't know me, I can create an account and fill out an application and get an eligibility determination initially. So that's an important nuance. Now, you might ask me, what's magic about February 6th, right? Turns out February 6th is the first Saturday after federal open enrollment closes. Now, you all know, right, Medicaid, every day is an open enrollment day. But for our consumers, open enrollment's always very confusing. They see, you know, articles and ads and media that says, hey, go take care of getting health insurance. And so we wanted to limit the confusion for our consumers and not, you know, put up a big press release, have a big conference in the middle of open enrollment and say, hey, come this way. Instead, we're going to turn it on quietly. We're going to make it available when we have people on the phones who can answer questions so that when a consumer first has an experience with it, we'll be able to provide appropriate support. And then over time, in the course of 2016, we'll expand the hours of operations. So as much as I'd love to sit here and tell you that we didn't have any problems with Go Live, that's in fact actually not true. Turns out it was a good idea for me to try starting to process application 10 days before Go Live so we could work out some of the kinks. The account transfer between us and the federal government, it turns out our federal partners made some changes in the data format. So when you bring up a new system, they give you specifications. You build your system to meet those specifications. You test. And we even had a third party watch us test and certify, we call that attestation, that we did things right. We did all that stuff. On day one, we get the first account transfer, and it doesn't match. So when the data format doesn't match, the software doesn't work, right? So I had to hold account transfers and make modifications to the system in order to be able to process that information. I am pleased to say, as of about 3.5 hours ago, we started processing account transfers in an automated way with a special team at the Oregon Health Authority. So that was problem number one.
Can I ask a question there,
please,
Mr. Chair?
Oh, absolutely.
That was the Kentucky system that changed their specifications?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. So the Kentucky system doesn't have a connection to federalhealthcare.gov because they're a state-based marketplace. The Kentucky system that we came was like the Cover Oregon IT system if it had worked. And so this is brand new functionality that was taking the Kentucky core system and building a pipe between us and the federal government. It was the federal government who changed their specifications.
Without telling any of the states.
So it turns out we're the last to the party. And so all the other states may have had this issue in previous implementations. And so we're working through with our federal partners what the discrepancy was. I'm a firm believer that sometimes states have experience and don't actually communicate with CMS what their experience was. So I am spending time explaining to CMS all my pain so that we can prevent future states from having the same experience that Oregon did. So number two, we have, I'm sorry, okay. Were you done?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Issue number two, so the one system has many, many interfaces. So I connect to federal data sources that it's at a place called the Federal Data Services Hub. I have interfaces with the MMIS. I actually have interfaces with other legacy systems inside of the Oregon Health Authority. When you have an application the size and scale.
I can't help. I've been resisting asking this question. Is MMIS working?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee.
Information
MMIS is our claims processing system. So if you remember that second slide, we do eligibility in one. MMIS is enrollment and claims processing. CCOs have their own systems. Of course the MMIS is working. Are there issues with the MMIS? Absolutely. And are we working with our CCO partners to identify and address those appropriately as part of a budget note that I think came out of the last legislative session? Yes.
There's some discussion about it.
Yes, we are absolutely. But is the MMIS processing claims on a regular basis? Yes. Am I sending enrollment transactions that result in Oregonians getting enrollment cards for the Oregon Health Plan? Yes. So when you ask me, is it working? My answer is yes. Is it working perfectly, flawlessly, in the way we all want? Nobody could tell you that.
Thank you.
The problem with issue number two is when you have an application that's this complicated with the number of interfaces that it has, every system has planned maintenance windows, right? And so when you have planned maintenance, that means you're bringing down a system for a particular purpose. When you have an application that's connected to like 27 interfaces, everybody has their own maintenance window, right? And so we have had issues where our federal partners will bring down a verification service or MMIS has a planned outage. And in that period of time, I can't use my system in the way that I expect to use it when all of the interfaces are working. And so we've had some incidents, we would call them, based on availability of other systems. And so we're doing work now to try and see how many of those systems' planned outages can we move to be the same so that we minimize the experience to consumers once we open the front door, right? Right now, from an eligibility processing perspective, we're limited in the number of hours that we use it. So from a productive availability perspective, we don't have very much exposure here. But once we turn it on to consumers and consumers have expectation to be able to use it when it's convenient for them at home, we have greater exposure. But I'll tell you, I have the best system integration firm in the country. So our partners at Deloitte, who are here in the room, have a monitoring team whose job it is to monitor all of the interfaces. And I got a 911 about a week ago, and the technical manager for Deloitte says, "Oh my God, you have to call somebody at CMS. They're down. And so I light up a chain of phone calls and emails to CMS. And it turns out that we were the first state in the nation to report an outage. They were down for 90 seconds. And we knew and had lit them up about the fact that they were down before they even reported the incident command. And so the Federal Data Services Hub called and said, "We think you might have the best monitoring team in the whole nation." And that's a direct partnership with our system integration firm, Deloitte, and the caliber of people they bring to this project. Issues number three is really about, so when we brought this system here, we said we're going to invest in the Oregon State Data Center of the Department of Administrative Services. We wanted to be able to control the infrastructure and not be subject to a vendor having control of our equipment. The problem is that I think everyone underestimated the size and complexity of the one system. So I have 562 servers. Almost all of the infrastructure components of the one system touch major portions of the state data center. And so we're having negotiations with them right now about how to expand their operational support model to service us in the way we need to be serviced. It works really well right now from a 8 to 5, Monday to Friday operational perspective. And they have monitoring that happens after hours in partnership with our monitoring team. But we're going to demand a level of service for them that they aren't currently staffed once we open the applicant portal up. And so we're having conversations with them about that. And then issue number 4, Dr. Shahan will talk to you a little bit about. So we knew when we turned on this new system that the eligibility workers at the Oregon Health Authority were going to need time to get used to it. You don't automatically become proficient in it. Like every time you have Word upgraded on your computer and you're like, where did that button go? You have to get people to know and understand how to use the system. And so, but we have workload that has to be done every day, and our federal partners expect for us to do eligibility determinations in a reasonable period of time. And so we're working very hard to make sure that the workflow that's being created is being handled appropriately in order to meet the federal compliance requirements for eligibility applications. So I thought it might be fun for you to just see sort of by the numbers. So I picked a day, December 31st. The system had been up officially for 16 days, unofficially for 24 or so. At that point, we had created more than 7,000 applications. We had enrolled more than 4,000 people all the way through MMIS into the Oregon Health Plan. We had actually denied some people for benefits. So in fact, we have folks who come to us who are not eligible or closures that need to be made. We had referred people to the FFM, right? So I talk about when they're ineligible, I send them to the federal marketplace. And we had more than 765 users log into the system. So it's important for you to know that that's not just folks who work for Director Saxton at the Oregon Health Authority. We use a bunch of shared services of the Department of Human Services and the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery to do coordination of things like third-party liability, client maintenance unit to make sure that we have no duplicate individuals. And so that number is more than just eligibility workers. It also includes the staff on my project and the staff at Deloitte who have access to the system. But it's not an inconsequential number when you look at the end user count of most applications in state government. I think at the end of the day, in terms of state employees, it will be almost 1,200 who have access to be able to make some modification in the system.
Is that 15% or so denial rate the common expected rate?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. So it's very interesting for us to study denials initially because there are many reasons for a person to be denied. You could be denied because you're ineligible. You could actually be denied for MAGI eligibility because you've already been determined for non-MAGI eligibility, and so we make a referral. We first assess you for income Medicaid and then make a referral. So this number, we don't have a really good sense of whether it's representative of the total. What we know is we're processing applications that were at the end of the last round of renewals, and those are people who have had maybe the longest period of time since they've had a redetermination done. And so I think we think it's about average, but I don't think we really have quality enough data that I can tell you with certainty that that's the case. So I would expect you to ask me every time we come back what that rate is and how it plays out. And in 12 months, I'll be able to tell you in a very consistent, solid, system-generated way what you can expect from the caseload.
The question is, do we expect to knock off 15% every time we... Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Just one quick question. I don't know if you have the answer to it, but is there a correlation between the 728 or the individuals that are denied benefits and the 765 or the individuals that logged in? That 765, are those, were they successfully, or is there a correlation between those trying to do it on their own not being successful versus employees doing it?
Co-Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden. So those numbers are not related, and I'm sorry that I created confusion. The 765 are actually employees. of the Oregon Health Authority, or are people who are working on the project. And so those are folks who are using the system, the worker portal. No end users have access currently. They won't have access until I turn on applicant portal. So what's happening here is some number of these 765 are logging in every day to the one system. They're taking a paper application and data entering that application. So these 765 create 7,386. Once you get created, you go through all the steps, you determine eligibility. Of those 7,386 applications, 4,000 people were enrolled. So those are people who are going to be eligible. 728 were denied. There are some. There's a delta there, right? You would add those two things together and say, Sarah, those things don't mean the same. But that's because I have individuals in the second two bullets, and applications could have multiple people on it, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, there's steps in process, right? So on December 31st, I'd open 7,000, but I hadn't worked them all because I have to stop at certain places in the process. If the information an applicant provides to me, I can't electronically verify, then I send them a request for additional information, for example. And so then the application stops while that notice goes out, a consumer or client provides additional information, and then we attach that back to the record and continue to authorization. So you expect there to be a difference, which is why, Co-Chair, I can't answer your question about straight out the percentage of denials. Is that clearer?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Dr. Shahan is going to talk to you for a few minutes about some operational considerations.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for records, I'm Dr. Varsha Chauhan, and it's an honor and privilege to hit the road running in the first 5 weeks on the topmost priority for OHA, which is to stabilize and optimize the system. So building on what Sarah Miller just presented to you, as you see, numbers are very important. So what we have done as what I have done with the team is one of the most important thing is to create a dashboard. And this dashboard that you see up here on the screen is not only going to help us track progress and show improvement, but it enables everyone who is working with the system to stabilize and optimize it to make help us make timely, better, faster, and smarter decisions. This dashboard is also going to get everyone on the same page, so we look at the numbers and we understand the numbers in the same way, and they are coming and being reported from a true source. The other thing is it will also help us share what success looks like to reach our vision, which is Healthy Oregon. And finally, what I think a dashboard definitely does, which will do for all of us, it will help us cut through all the data clutter that we have, the numbers that are floating in this universe, and get down to the basic essentials. So as you can see the dashboard, I would not get too much into detail here, but it would walk us, whenever we report, it would walk us through where we are with the eligibility, where are members, whether they are MAGI, non-MAGI, or the CHIP eligible, where are we, how are we doing with our enrollment, how are we doing with redeterminations, renewals? How are we doing with closures? And as you can see in the dashboard, we complete it by what are our issues, the most important issues we are going to resolve in 30 days. So that keeps everyone informed. Moving to
Chair,
this.
You got a question?
Yes.
If I might. So I assume the information here will be automatically populated from the other system?
Co-Chair Greenlich, Representative Lively, yes, in fact, many of these data elements that will populate the actual columns will be system-generated numbers. Now, what you know is that the one system is only actually going to do MAGI eligibility and CHIP eligibility, so the rows that are non-MAGI related will have to come out of a different eligibility system. And the targets will be set by the operational experts to help motivate production and performance of the employees. But these actually crosswalk to CMS-required reporting, and every number I can system generate, I will system generate in a consistent way.
Thank you.
This is a pretty complex table for a dashboard. One of the things that most dashboards have is four major dials that you look at. This has got a lot of moving parts. How do you prioritize among these actual and
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, thank you for that question. It is complicated, but one of the things we find consistently with our stakeholders, whether they be CCOs, member advocates, et cetera, is that it's very easy to lose the forest for the trees because we have separated out the Medicaid system and done different tracking devices. In reality, by putting them on one sheet so that we see what's happening with our entire Medicaid population every month and how we're performing to target, our goal and our hope is that my biggest concern is, first of all, clarity for our workforce so they know every day what we're trying to do and how we're trying to do it. We haven't had that common vision in the past, and it's really critical to us managing member services successfully. Equally important to me is that our stakeholders, whether it's legislative stakeholders or community advocates, be looking at a common set of data so that they can have understanding and access to the data. Right now, the way our data sets are configured, it's very hard for anyone to track our performance. So we hope to be very transparent so that you can track our performance, we can track our performance, and most importantly, the people sitting at the data entry system know every day where they are, because that's how you get the level of effectiveness that we're seeking. So it's a little complex, and particularly here, it's a little small, but that's going to be a good thing as we move forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I, one more. So the target going to start off being based on historical numbers? I'm trying to understand the relationship to the target to the actual.
The target is critical not only to us, because we should be getting a certain, in order to ensure access to health care, we have to be sure we're getting a certain number of volume of people through the system effectively. The target is also really important to CMS, our partner. Mm-hmm. They have very clear standards and objectives for what Oregon is required to do, again, so that they can ensure access to health care. So, thank you.
Thank you.
So moving to the next slide, which kind of ties to the questions just asked, if we look at on the top of the slide, you look at some targets here. This is for our renewal leveling plan. Our goal is to, within the next 11 months, process all these members. And so you could see the targets already set there. So those are timelines that we work with, which help us set targets, and we could be held accountable to. The rest of the slide walks us through, after the application portal go live, we need to stabilize and optimize the system. And what we have done, the whole team has together worked on breaking it down into three major phases. One is a 45-day sprint, then a 90-day, and a 180-day sprint. And we have been specific to dates as well. Let's look into the 45 days key activities, which could be bringing the leadership alignment, DHS, OHA. How are we going to work to stabilize the system further? How are we going to, once again, take a step back now that we have the system in place and look at the entire life cycle, understand the life cycle, bring everyone at the same page of understanding so that when we see something getting deviated from the targets, we can all make informed decisions. Operational metrics and reporting, being a Lean Six Sigma Master Black Belt, that's really not only important to me, but to everyone. And so being a fan of that, definitely the first product is the dashboard. And then vendor procurement, who could help us with our call center, improving efficiencies, giving some learning lessons so we can be effective and our members could be happy as well. So those are our 45 days key activities in order to meet the timeline of stabilization and optimization. In 90 days again.
What does organizational optimization mean?
I'm sorry.
Organizational optimization.
Yes. So optimization is on the next arrow where we would start optimizing the whole system from July.
Your 45-day has organizational.
Oh, it means
what
that
is organizational optimization as your 45-day piece. I was wondering what you're going to do to optimize your organization in the next 45 days.
What would we do to optimize? That's a good question, Chair Greenlick. optimization, of course, does happen at simultaneously while we are trying to stabilize. What we would do is start looking at all the business processes, what processes are broken, what needs to be fixed, and where is the workforce? How is the workforce going? Where are the gaps in the workforce? How are we going to fill the workforce? What are the other improvements that need to be made?
Oh, after 45 days, you'll have the optimum organization.
I wish.
No, that's serious.
No, it says July 2016 through June 2018.
Yes.
For the 45 days?
No, 2 years.
Oh, that's the 2 year. I see. You're going to be optimized over. Good. I thought it was just going to take you 45 days. Okay. You'll optimize OHA in 2 years. That'd be good.
Thank you. So continuing to the 90-day sprint, that's where we would focus on some of the member services organization restructure, which is really very important with the systems in place, we knowing where we stand, what we need to improve, staffing plans, and HR business partner plan, cultural transformation plan, and continuously refreshing our plans. Plans are something not just made, written, and put on the shelf. We need to continuously look at them and refresh them. And finally, in our 180-day sprint that ends in July, which will stabilize the system, is really looking at performance excellence. How can we be the best? That goes into optimization phase, that kicks in into optimization phase, where we would look into the business processes, optimize them, make them a class excellence, organization optimization, look at the workforce, trainings needed, skills needed, and other improvement activities. So that's where the focus is going to be.
Just around
just a piece, a tip of the iceberg.
Just around eligibility. Just around this thing.
Yes, just around.
I'm sorry. Do you have a question?
No. No, I don't. I'm trying to follow it. It's a lot.
It is a very complex process. We've simplified it, but there is hundreds of people, hundreds of hours, a lot of work going, a lot of thinking going, and wheels are turning continuously all the time.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I'm clear, so this is literally, I mean, if I'm thinking about the total organization, I'm trying to understand this separate from, because this is starting over, is it not? I mean, this is starting from the point where it didn't work to getting the system it does versus OHA, the organization. Or am I missing something?
Chair Green, like members of the committee, this is not a start over in that for the last year we have had a large workforce committed to eligibility systems, and frankly, our workforce has been working against the technology and against the software. So, for example, they have been sitting with four screens in front of them and moving people and folks on the phone through those four screens because we had no other option. We now have improved with the new Deloitte effort and Sarah's effort. We have the one eligibility system for the MAGI population. It is a huge step forward, but it gives us the opportunity to look at not only our training modules, but our technology, our phone lines. We now know, after 1 year's experience, we know where peak calls are coming in and what we have to do to open phone lines. So we've been making progress over the course of the last year. We now have a better system, and I think where we are strongly focused right now is we expect to be making progress. This plan you see before you is to make progress every month going forward, and to hold ourselves accountable in that, to that prior document of seeing real significant change. For example, we have to look at the question of Sarah's point earlier about when other systems are down and we can't access them. We need to pair that information with when people are calling us or when people are available to enroll in Medicaid, which is oftentimes in the evening. So we have a work process to look at when those calls come in from people. We have a work process to look at, gosh, do they want to call us on Saturday? If they do, that's probably a great time if you're working to call for your Medicaid eligibility, depending on your work schedule. So those are the processes we need to put in place. When we met with managers last Friday evening and we had them just kind of throw into the air all the things they'd like us to address. I think we had a very rich conversation from the operating side about what processes we should prioritize first for improvement and refinement and access. So
I was reacting, though. The reason that I was reacting is to the verbiage. I mean, I know I've been involved in 15 different management revolutions over my 40 years,
that's all.
50 years experience, something like that. I've survived a few of them. The notion that somehow you're going to create an optimal organization in 2 years or in 100 years is, arrogant might be too strong a term, but it's an aggressive objective. But if you really want us to hold you to it, then I hope we'll be back here and say, now you have the perfect organization, you've optimized it.
So just to be clear, Chair Greenlick, as the person who feels the accountability on a daily basis, this is to optimize our membership experience part of our organization.
Just get it better.
Well, all for it.
Get it better is not bad.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively.
Optimization is a way of saying better.
One more specific example I can give you. Right, because of our data conversion process, redeterminations are not using the system in the way that they will in 12 months. So for the next 12 months, she's going to work on the current set of processes, and then we'll have a new set of processes that we have to use and develop. And so there's an evolution as we use the system in new and different ways that will require continued enhancement to make sure we're appropriately servicing Oregonians.
You're an experienced person in this area. In your lifetime, how many, systems have you looked into that you had, whether it was your bank or your insurance company or your airline, that was optimal in your terms?
Chair Greenlick, I can't count one of them.
That's my point. My point is, some are better than others, and the objective to make it as best as you can, given your limited constraints, it seems to me not bad. Optimization, maybe not.
Chair Greenlick,
please go. Yes.
I know you might want improvement as opposed to, although I do see optimize as a little different than optimal.
Yeah.
Optimal is like perfect. Optimize is get as far as you can get is how I interpret it, but maybe improvement. Mm-hmm. But mine is just actually a more basic question. I'm trying really hard to follow along with this. I think, and I'm trying to understand where we are. I get that you have to redo a lot of your things because of this mother and child. Like, that was really helpful. I lodged onto that. But what I've been hearing in the community is that many people are being dropped because we don't have the fast-track system that we used to have. And I thought our numbers were somewhere up at 650,000, and I see these numbers as like 550,000 or, average 55,000 a month, or you expect to do 550 over the next 11 months. I'm worried that people are being dropped. I'm worried that people aren't getting the message. So mine is at a much bigger level. Like, who's getting dropped? In all of this, we're trying to go from this system to this, and we're in transition.
Yeah.
I hear about the long application, the forms that are coming up. I hear that the systems that we used to have to connect people automatically that were on TANF and others are no longer being done. I've heard that people don't realize that they're supposed to re-up, and so they're not. And so I'm really kind of concerned at a greater level about not the system but the people that it's serving.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, I want to make some factual clarifications that will help you understand the numbers that you're seeing.
Okay.
And then I want to suggest that some of the questions you're raising, certainly the technology helps give us the foundation for future forward. Mm-hmm. It does not change or make better necessarily people's past experience. So let me be really clear. 560,576 are applications, households, cases. They are not individuals, right?
Okay.
And so on average, you have 2.1 or 2.4, I can't remember. So when you take that number times that factor, you get to about 1.1 million people, right? So those numbers we have to understand differently. I think certainly you're raising a concern that I've been in many conversations with OHA leadership and with member advocate organizations about what the appropriate processes are. And we're in dialogue right now with our federal partners about what their expectation is relative to redeterminations and how they want us to approach it and what methods are approved. Now, the unfortunate reality is there are federal policy changes that have made certain tools that were available to us in the past no longer available to us. The new technology requires certain data to be available in order to be able to give eligibility benefits and create a case appropriately that makes other processes unavailable to us. We are very clear and are working very diligently to both meet the letter of the law and the federal guidance, but also the spirit, because every day this membership team, leadership team, and the people on the project are fighting to create ways for Oregonians to have access to care. So, you know, I think we would all collectively say we come from a place where there have been limitations that have negatively impacted people, but this is the first step in making sure we have a solid foundation to make sure that folks can have access in the future. And I think you'll see once the leadership team gets to stop worrying about the technology because it's consistently performing, they can spend time focused on how to make other parts of the system work more appropriately. So that's what I'd say for my chair.
Chair Green, like members of the committee, the other tools we have put in place during this year of further transition is the community assisters were recontracted this year to help people in the community. We are also committed, and this is part of the work that Varsha and Mark Fairbanks, our chief financial officer, have undergone, is we need to be sure while we're making these improvements and advances that people are picking up the phone and calling us. And that's part of the issue of looking at the workflow and the timing, because there's going to be a period of time here, particularly while we are addressing the conversion of part of the technology. Remember, this is the Magi side. We have the rest of the populations you identified. We need people to contact us when they're having a barrier, and we'll address it directly. We are, this grid that you saw that is complex is giving us the ability to look on a monthly basis compositely at the system, really for the first time. It brings the TANF population in. We'll be monitoring them on a regular basis, monthly basis, at a minimum. And it also gives us, Mark Fairbanks has been working directly with DHS, because we're now able to say, what are the parts of this that we need to start messaging differently now that we have clarity around how these members can renew, how they can process their benefits more effectively than they have in the past year. One of the steps forward we're making now as of December 15th is DHS workers at the DHS offices can call up a screen and see the person's benefits. They can't interact with it in this year, but that's a huge quantum step forward for a DHS caseworker with someone they've worked with every day for years to actually be able to problem solve. Again, they still have to get us on the phone. It's clunky, but it is a step forward in advancement. I think one of the things that the Oregon Health Authority has committed itself to is, and part of the reason we wanted to create this template, is we want to share with all of our stakeholders how fast we're able to go under our current constraints and what opportunities we have for acceleration and improvement. And we want to do that collaboratively. We simply have not been able to do that throughout the course of the last year as effectively as we would like to do. We share their concerns. We have been successful in the past at delaying closures. We kind of pushed the limits of CMS's tolerance on that. Mm-hmm. But we do have a careful closure process that will be enhanced and improved over time. But I would be the first to say that part of the reason this is our number one operational priority is concern for our members, and frankly, concern for the really critical need for the legislative body to have accuracy going forward as we address the financial parameters of this program.
Thank you.
So we're committed to it.
So one more slide and we'll finish up on this part. So you've heard us talk about how we're going to use data to inform operational decision making and establish reporting progress with our federal partners. We actually sent the first print job to the print plant to initiate one system generated renewals and redeterminations. And so we expect the first renewal mailing to be mailed on February 1st. The applicant portal go live we've talked about. And I just have to take every opportunity, because I'm in service to both agencies, to say we're going to take everything we learned in this implementation. And DHS, who will be in front of you in February talking about wanting to use this same system for eligibility for DHS programs, will benefit. I think one of the unique characteristics of the Oregon Medicaid program is you have two agencies doing eligibility determination for portions of it. And we have to look at the system as a whole and cross agency boundaries to do that. My service as a DHS employee to OHA has helped develop relationships that I think make that easier to have a partnership conversation on the go forward. And so we'll be working together both from an eligibility perspective specific to Medicaid, but also so that DHS can learn in its desire to use the one system for integrated eligibility to service Oregonians.
Chair, can I make a quick comment?
Please.
I'm really delighted to hear that, and I know that you're going to be hearing in the course of the next month or so about the EITC, mm-hmm. making sure that we use every avenue possible, since we are 50th out of 50 states mm-hmm. in our utilization rate of EITC, which means we're leaving $126 million on the table, federal dollars that could be in people's pockets. We are trying to figure out a way through your one system to make sure that there's a tickler there, that if people are eligible for certain things, that they are probably eligible for EITC. So,
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Geyer, I had a long conversation with Representative Nathanson on this topic, and certainly DHS is interested as part of the initial assessment process of the integrated eligibility planning to talk about feasibility there, and whether certainly from a long-term perspective that referral need could potentially be met. I think the question is, DHS won't be able to take advantage of this functionality in one until 2018, mm-hmm. and certainly that's a long time to leave Oregonians without access appropriately. And so I just want to make sure that we're being appropriate.
I think we need to move on. This has been a really good presentation.
Good. Thank you.
I think it reassures us quite a bit, hearing about a success rather than a failure.
It's nice. Very exciting to use the system. I have to say, I can't remember which exact day it was that we printed out one of the forms in basic Chinese, but it's a real step forward. Thank you for your interest. Thanks, Varsha. The next thing we'd like to talk about, this is kind of OHA's biggest hits for you today, but we have been having lots of conversations over the last 6 months about what about the waiver. And so we're very excited today both to introduce our new Medicaid director, Lori Koiner, but also our previous Medicaid director, Leslie Clement, and who has had direct responsibility for the waiver development process to you. And we're going to walk you through where we are on our waiver. So,
good afternoon. I'm Leslie Clement, and I'm the Director of Health Policy and Analytics, and it's good to be here. And
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, I'm Lori Koiner and the State Medicaid Director.
So today, I'm going to take the committee through a little bit of a 101 on what is Oregon's 1115.
We have about 10 minutes for this
I'll
speech.
Do this really, really quick.
Okay.
It won't be nearly as complex, and I promise. I promise. So I just wanted to give the committee an overall framework of, you know, when you're a state Medicaid program, you have really three major avenues for authority. For any state that wants a Medicaid program, they have to have what's called the state plan. And in the state plan, it's a contract between the state and the federal government that defines eligibility for the Medicaid program, the benefits, and the pricing within existing federal Medicaid guidelines. And then many, many states, and Oregon has an exceptional performance record with its home and community-based waivers. This is an avenue that CMS, the federal government, allows states to pursue to cover home and community services as an alternative to just going to the mandated nursing home or institutional benefit. And then finally, which is the focus of our conversation today, is we have 1115 demonstration waivers, and this avenue of authority allows for states to pursue a whole range of projects outside of the parameter of the state plan. So there's a couple of things. An 1115 waiver allows CMS to allow to waive certain federal regulation or pieces of law to approve experimental pilot or demonstration programs. And a demonstration may allow a state to test new approaches to financing and delivery systems, test approach new approaches to defining and changing benefits. I think I went too far. Okay. A couple things to keep in mind. A demonstration may allow a state to provide services that aren't typically covered in the Medicaid program. It could may allow you to expand eligibility to individuals who would not otherwise be covered, to allow you to offer incentives to providers to develop new models of care, and to implement other changes or innovations. You could select any one or all of those things. A demonstration at the end of the day must be budget neutral. Can't cost the federal government or the state more money. So the Oregon Health Plan is often called the 1115 demonstration program. It was created in 1994, and it allowed Oregon to create a Medicaid health plan delivery system, a new approach to financing and delivering services. It allowed us to develop and implement the prioritized list of healthcare services. No other state in the country has that approach. And it allowed us to expand coverage to parents and childless adults. So that was an eligibility change. Oops. Quick history. And many changes to our 1115 demonstration program over time. In 1997, we made a change to our Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, to allow eligible CHIP members to have the same benefits and same delivery system as our Medicaid members. So CHIP and Medicaid in Oregon look exactly the same for children. In 2002, Oregon established the OHP Plus and the OHP Standard benefits, and that included that Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Many demonstration programs across the country do these premium assistance programs. In 2007-2009, we expanded CHIP and created the Healthy Kids Program. And in 2012, where we are today, we established Oregon's Health Transformation. Healthcare transformation. So this is all familiar to you. Our transformation goals were primarily to improve the health of all Oregonians, improve the care, and reduce the growth in Medicaid spending, and we would accomplish those goals through our coordinated care organizations. You may have seen this slide. It's been around for a while. It's kind of a before and after. It was our expectation as we moved into this new delivery system with coordinated care organizations. We had fragmented care. We expected the care to be coordinated and patient-centered. We had disconnected funding streams, so we had separate mental health organizations, separate dental care organizations, separate physical health organizations, and then bits and pieces of carve-out. We wanted them all to come in together under a global budget with a fixed rate of growth. We wanted to include financial incentives, so moving away from a fee-for-service widget approach to performance-based with outcomes. We had more limits on service. It was an old budget tool that how do you control your budget? You cut benefits or you cut eligibility. We wanted to provide services with greater flexibility to help reach beyond that medical world into the healthcare. Our healthcare delivery system was disconnected from population health.
Are we almost done with 101?
almost. And then we also wanted, one of the basic premises of the coordinated care organization was to make it local and have local control and flexibility. So I want to talk about our strategy moving forward. It's a three-step process. The first step is to address areas of our current waiver where we have legislative direction, where we think our legislative intent isn't quite reflected in our current waiver, and so we're pursuing that. That's work underway right now. Our second step is to extend the waiver. We think that we have, and we've heard from Oregonians, that we think we have a good policy framework. We might not be executing on that policy framework to the extent that we should, but we like our prioritized list, we like our coordinated care organizations, and we like the premise that it's more than just medical care, but it's larger health. And then our third step is to amend, and that is to reach beyond the next phases of transformation. So our first this first step includes two amendments that I wanted to let you know that we have underway. We have submitted an amendment to extend the Hospital Transformation Performance Program. That's to align with legislative statute that was passed this last session. We've submitted that amendment, and we're waiting for approval. The second amendment has gotten a lot of attention, and it's really about, do we have the global budget methodology that we think we have? Is it where we want it to be? And are our flexible services defined in policy really flexible enough to encourage utilization? And so we have contracted with MNAT, who is a Medicaid consulting company, and they are working through some methodologies with us. They'll be meeting with stakeholders in these next months to develop a concept paper and to submit a waiver amendment so that we can get on better track with our global budget methodology. Our second step is to extend, and as I said, you know, in the context of where we're at, lots of changes going on, lots of political changes going on at the federal level. Our stance is really that we have the right framework in place, and what we want is very minor changes to our existing waiver after we receive the amendments and request an extension. And then the third and final step is really to look out on the horizon and see where we have some opportunities. So this indicates the top one is a substance use disorder waiver. It's a waiver that was offered by CMS to states to pursue to really enhance the recovery-oriented delivery system that we'd like to see here. And we've initiated engagement with a stakeholder advisory group to start that work. The requirements associated with that waiver are fairly daunting, and so we wanted to get stakeholders engaged sooner rather than later so that we have the time to develop the necessary operational implementation requirements so that we're not finding ourselves having a policy approved before we're really ready to execute and implement it. And then we also, you know, you've heard a lot about behavioral health systems, and do we really have a transformed behavioral health system? I think most people would say no, not really yet. There's some pockets of innovation going on in the state that are great, but we need to push further and accelerate. We also feel like there's opportunities with our duals population. These are individuals who are covered by Medicare and Medicaid. They have a higher prevalence of chronic disease, a higher prevalence of behavioral health issues, and we think we can do better with that population. So all these step one, step two, and step three are not necessarily we're going to do this one and wait, we're going to do this one and wait. We're actually initiating different levels of conversations and different levels of work to achieve all three of these steps right now. That does wrap up the formal presentation. There is a link here for you if you want to dive deeper and learn more about the waiver. And then I have also included both Lori's and my email. Please feel free to call us or email us with any questions, and we'd be glad to answer any questions you might have right now.
Yes.
I have two quick questions on it.
Sure.
One is, I keep hearing about a housing waiver.
And are you exploring that? And what I've heard is it's hard for us to do in general because of our 3.4 cap on growth, but maybe we could do it with a carve-out like on the long-term care. Anything you can say about that? I know states are looking at that right now.
So what we think we can do is we think we can do better with connecting with housing. And obviously this legislature invested some funds in that. We know that Portland is doing the same thing. The Medicaid program, federal Medicaid law, does not allow for federal Medicaid dollars to pay for room and board. What it does allow us to do is pay for supports and services that occur in those housing areas. So we are working right now with stakeholders to see what other policies might we pursue. It may not be through an 1115 waiver. It can be a state plan change. We think we have a lot of the authorities we need to make improvements in this area. So it's more of an administration and operational intention than it is a waiver change. So.
Okay, thank you. And my other question, just briefly. There's been anti-discrimination language in the past. Do those need to be built in to any of these waivers that they're doing, or is it clear that that carries over from past agreements, or do we need a separate amendment on it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, if any entity is going to use federal Medicaid dollars, they have to comply with federal Medicaid law. So that should cover it. There shouldn't be anything else that we need to seek for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. There are a couple of Medicaid items on the agenda of the committee. I wonder if you're prepared to talk about them.
The operational details, I think.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's Kenimer. Okay. This may answer what I'm. Let me hear what there is to say, and then I'll see. Thank you.
Well, I just have one question. So I'm trying to understand: is this routine, or is there some risk here?
So I've worked in Medicaid programs since 2001. This strategy is intended for us to really retain some of the special policies that we have to minimize any risks that with changes at the federal level, with the presidential election coming up, with changes that always occur in administration, that we are able to move quickly through with people who understand what Oregon's intending to do, understands our prioritized list, understands the coordinated care organization, so that we can get through into the next five-year waiver period with a minimal number of distractions and disruptions.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, on a slightly different note, I guess, understood in 2015 we passed Senate Bill 5526, which provided for dental services including dentures, partials, and crowns. And then there has been a postponement of that. And I understand there was a conversation with the Senate, and I'm trying to understand, do we have a date now for when this is going to be accomplished with CMS? And when we'll be notified, and when these will be taken care of financially.
Okay.
You can submit that.
I'll submit what we submitted to Helico.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Representative Kenimer, thank you for the question. We've done a detailed kind of work plan on how to get that done. Mm-hmm. The timeline, and I'm happy to go into what led to the delays, et cetera, but to skip to the end point,
yeah.
We're hoping to implement the 1st of April okay. instead of July, as previously announced, and there were some days. We have a narrative description of that, which we'll put in and make available to you. But we are focused and have a team working on that time frame.
Okay, and will you also be notifying the DCOs of this so they can?
I think they now.
Yes.
Very recently.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Some other issues on the agenda. Let's
quick
make sure.
Question on that one.
Yeah.
Have you? Thank you, Chair Greenlick. On the 45-day notice to CMS, has OHA submitted that?
For the. for the new rates?
Yeah, to include the dentures, partials, and the wisdom tooth extractions with what he's talking about.
Has that gone out of the office? Do we know?
No,
it hasn't. I don't think it has not.
When will that go
I think
out?
The current plan we're working on, there. Do you want to speak to that? Because
So the April 1st deadline includes the timeline lays out, so that does include a 45-day notice to CMS.
You need to identify.
It's 45 yourself. Days from now, right?
What?
It's 45 days from now. April.
That's
no,
March.
No, you have an extra 30
yeah.
days.
Yeah. So fine. We're working on the rate calculation. So. This is Lori Coyner. State Medicaid Director Chair Greenlick and Representative Hayden, we're working on the rates for the dental currently, and so we have to submit the amendment, and we've been working through the processes to make that happen and still obtain a review from CMS.
I understand the plans have agreed to waive the 60-day notice on this.
Right.
So in order to meet CMS requirement, you're telling me that by no later than February 15th, those will be turned in?
I believe that's the current plan.
Yes.
Okay.
For an April 1st, that's what it would require, so yes.
Okay.
We were working late last night on the logistics, so
we'll remember Valentine's Day.
Well, thank you, and Lynn Saxon, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Part of the component of that is we need universal in order to make it fit with CMS, we need universal authorization from the CCO. So that's underway. We expect to hope to have that by Friday, but our timeline would be to submit to CMS on February 15th.
Okay, and a couple of other issues on the agenda.
Yes.
2016 contracts.
We have signed 2016 contracts from the CCOs. We still have some more work to do on that work to close up a few details, and that is underway. I'm happy to elaborate, but.
No.
Okay. And then one of the things I want to talk about, just to be sure, and we sent this in our letter to you, is we have had numerous concerns about the length of the Oregon Health Plan eligibility form. And I just want to disclose that probably in October or November, I went online to use the new One eligibility system as a member to see how the eligibility forms worked, and we have room for improvement there. The forms are long, the process is slow, and we have a group of people working on both creating a form that is more manageable and also meets CMS expectations. Part of the reason for the multiple pages is the size of the size of the text we are required to use by law. But even with that said, we should be able to streamline the form, and we are working on that. It has gone from, I heard this morning, it used to be 57 pages, so we've made progress. We're in the 30s, but we need to get it down even further.
We've had an OHA director here who promised to reduce it from 12 pages to 8 pages.
Candidly,
I'm not sure how it got from 12 pages to 57 pages.
So, Chair Greenlick, I'm not going to make that promise to you today because I don't know that I can do that. But we are hard on reducing the number of pages.
Yeah. Even in its 30 form, it's pretty difficult. And the real key, I guess, is you have people behind available to help folks work their way through this form. I think that's the obvious.
Yes, Chair Greenlick, and I just want to underscore that for a minute because I get very anxious when I hear the stories of members who are struggling through the process. And as we all know, technology is a wonderful thing, and I'm very proud of Sarah Miller and her team and the advances we've made this year, but this is not a mature system yet. Our experience is analogous to many other states in the country. It's better than other states in the country. It's worse than others. But we always want to get people on the phone and are committed to getting them through the process, and we have language capacity. We have a very talented staff. And also, if anyone gets on the phone and doesn't have a good experience, I was with the Lutheran Refugee Organization last week for lunch, and they had a woman from another country who, when they asked for her address, she said, "I can't tell you." And so the conversation was ended. And it wasn't that she couldn't tell you. It was that she couldn't read the form, and she couldn't respond in our language. So if anything like that happens, please call me directly, and I will get people. We have done this for our represented workers. We've done this for organizations. Pick up the phone and call us. We want to fix it. We'll get it fixed.
I'm not going to call you. I'll call Beth Ann.
Even better. Perfect. Thank you.
The last item I think we have on this agenda is this question about Medicaid members being charged for balance billing kind of things. I know that's a crazy issue.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, it's an unfortunate issue, and it's very problematical because in our electronic age, oftentimes those members get put into collection agency processes and such that have a life of their own, and I have direct experience as a volunteer working with people through those systems. So we have currently, we've given you the numbers here, we have about 792 cases. That's about 1% of our total calls go to our client, our special client billing unit for resolution. I want to commend the CCOs for also for their population helping us with those billing problems. We have more work to do to improve the process. We have made significant progress, but not near enough. And we are going to be working with our member services unit, led by Dr. Shahan, to see what we can do as our other systems are making improvement, how we can directly address that billing problem. It is a real problem. We take responsibility for it. It is not where we would like it to be. But we have a sharp read on a monthly basis of what those problems are, and right now it's at about a 1% level, so it needs to improve.
Yes, sir. And then I think we'll let you get away and come back in a little bit after we talk to the folks in DCBS.
Thank you. Hayden? Thank you, Chair Greenlich. One quick question on a follow-up conversation that we had earlier, and this was before all the CCOs had signed contracts. And when you say they have signed, I'm assuming that's all current ones?
Yes.
And as far as the geographical service areas, there was an RFP put out, a request for proposal put out for that service area. Is that still current, or did the signatures on those contracts take place? Because I'm not sure where that's at. What is
Chair
that process?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, there is still a, we extended the timeline for submitting those service area agreement interest documents to, I believe it's April 21st. Do I have the right date? The reason we did that is on one contract, we had a notice of default filed in early December based on the 2016 rate methodology, and that's a matter currently under continued discussion and exploration. So we have to resolve that before we can withdraw the request for those interested in service area expansion. Again, our continuing requirement is to have ready capacity for all of our members on an ongoing basis. So that work is still underway.
There's code words going on here. I'm not sure.
If it wasn't,
would somebody translate this discussion for me into English?
So
there's a default on 2016.
There's a notice of default. As you know, we are in litigation with one of the 16 members, and we received a notice of default the beginning of December.
And 2016?
Yes. And so we have to resolve that issue.
What is the default?
And that's a subject of discussion with our lawyers probably the end of this week, the first part of next.
But she said you have contracts signed with all.
That's correct.
But you had a before 2016
before
default
the contracts
on 2016.
Were signed, a notice of default on the 2016 rate methodology.
So just to clarify, if it's not withdrawn, does that open up to non-existing CCOs to apply for that?
No, it is not.
It does not.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, no, it is not.
Okay.
Thank you.
I guess I don't need to understand everything. Thank you all very much for your good work. Can we talk a bit about now how the Oregon health insurance marketplace is going? Well, hello again.
Good afternoon.
You're flying on your own?
I am. It's hard to believe, I know.
Until later on.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the recently proud owner of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. I'm here to provide our third interim report to you on our adoption of that program and how things are going. What I want to do today is touch on four things. I'll talk a bit about our financial performance in operation of the marketplace, give you some current numbers on enrollment. We're, of course, in open enrollment right now. Talk a little bit about some of the specific outreach kinds of activities we're doing right now. And then I want to spend a little bit of time on new information since the last time I reported to you on the proposed federal charge for the use of the healthcare.gov platform and some of what we're doing in response to that.
And Pat, while you're sitting there, you might as well talk about the LC on 1332 waiver.
I can certainly do that as well.
Is Deanne here with
you? Oh, somebody else is. I'm sorry. I don't want to, my administrator is under control here. I don't. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Got it.
I know what you're saying.
We'll play it by ear. How about that?
Let's do that.
First, in terms of financial performance, of course, you have our report. My general observation would be all of our financial forecasts are wrong, and by that I mean all of our revenue figures are higher than expected, all of our expense figures are lower than expected. Our beginning balance that we inherited from Cover Oregon was lower than expected because they prepaid several million dollars worth of technology costs before transferring that to us, and so by virtually every financial metric, we are performing better than we anticipated at this point, to the point that we're going to be in a condition sometime relatively early in this biennium where we're going to be over the statutory guidance on what our fund balance should be and need to talk about a mechanism for how those funds can be rebated to carriers. So
that's an unusual report to get.
I could repeat it if you'd like.
Repeat it next year.
Yeah. Let me talk about enrollment. Actually, I just this afternoon got updated numbers. We get these numbers weekly from Health and Human Services. Right now, we have enrolled 134,629 Oregonians in health care plans. That compares to our full year of open enrollment, our full open enrollment period last year of 112,000, with 3 weeks to go yet in open enrollment. So we're up about 18%. Over where we were last year. A couple of things about those numbers. First, over the next 3 weeks, what I expect to happen is in the next 2 weeks, there will be very small ticks up and then some larger bump that will happen in the last week because that's the week that open enrollment closes and nothing clarifies the mind like a deadline. And then after that, the number will go back down because we'll move from gross enrollments to what we call effectuated enrollments, the number for people that actually pay their policies. Last year, I think we effectuated about 85% of policies. So we don't expect this year to be substantially different from last year. So we're very encouraged about our enrollment numbers. We're also this week going to be releasing these are numbers that come from CMS as they sign people up on the healthcare.gov portfolio. We have separately been asking the insurance companies on a periodic basis how many people they're signing up. We're going to be releasing that number later this week. It's somewhat lower, which tracks with our experience last week. And what we find happening is the CMS data is actually rather better because they know who has signed up, and there's some kind of a lag that varies from carrier to carrier of that information working its way from healthcare.gov to showing up on the individual carrier's books and then being reported to us. Basically the lines begin to converge as you move a little bit past open enrollment. We think that'll happen again. So that's enrollment. Let me talk a little bit about outreach, because I think this will relate to the conversation about platform. We've been doing a number of things that are Oregon-based approaches to how we're trying to encourage this rate of enrollment. The federal government is doing mass market advertising, TV, those kinds of things. We're not really in that space at all. This week and next week, we're doing some storming of community colleges aimed at encouraging enrollments in the 18 to 34 age group, which is incredibly important to the financial health of the marketplace. I should point out that our enrollment in that space right now is about 25%, and so we're in a not quite to the target we like to be at, but we're in a very healthy place in terms of enrollment of young people. We're working with industry partners and other regulatory agencies, the Trucking Association, the Real Estate Association, the Board of Tax Preparers, the Employment Department, BOLI, those kinds of agencies and organizations that typically work with lots of the kinds of businesses that have a lot of demand for individuals that that are their employees where there's not a health care benefit offered to be able to sign up and doing outreach. We've had a very productive relationship with the Department of Human Services over the SNAP or food stamp benefits. We benefit recipients. We've got information from them, a list of folks who qualify for SNAP benefits but don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. That's a prime target for people who are eligible for tax credits, and we have done outreach targeted there. We've also been working with emergency rooms, benefit coordinators at hospitals, urgent care providers who are sort of at the very front line of contact of figuring out someone doesn't have insurance and are they eligible at this time of year or in other times when outside of open enrollment. We've also fortunately not had lots of opportunities with mass layoffs over this last year, but we have had some experience now getting in front of groups of employees subject to layoff to talk about health, the marketplace as a cost-effective alternative to COBRA benefits that can often, with tax credits, be quite a bit less expensive for them. Those are all things that are tailored in Oregon, delivered by Oregonians to our populations that we think help explain some of this success. And I should say that right now we have the third highest in the nation percentage of enrollment as compared to last year, so the third highest increase of all states in the country. We have the second highest penetration for percentage of eligible insured in the country. And so I think those things that we're doing are successful. I also need to point out we're not doing that with a whole bunch of line staff at Department of Consumer and Business Services. As you'll recall, our staffing footprint is really pretty small for this program. We're doing that in partnership with community organizations, with the sisters, and especially with the agent community, who are play an incredibly important role in helping people get covered. I think it's especially true given that we have an embarrassment of riches, a dozen companies offering over 100 plan choices to Oregonians. That's actually a really complicated market that would be difficult, I think, for any of us in this room to negotiate, let alone some of the folks that we're really trying hard to work to get to. And so agents play a critical role in that. So that's where we are and the kinds of things that we're doing right now. Let me take a minute and talk about the platform, healthcare.gov. I think when we were here last time, we've been using that platform for free, this open enrollment period and last open enrollment period, and we knew it was going to cost something going forward. The federal government has now proposed that it will cost 3% of premium to use that platform. A couple of things about that. If you're just a state that has walked away from the Affordable Care Act and aren't doing anything, it costs 3.5% of premium. So 85% of their cost is technology according to the proposed rate that they have rolled out. That's rather higher than we expected. And the other piece of information that's important to know is all that work that we're doing right now on plan management and outreach and all those kinds of things, we denominate what we charge differently. They're using percentage of premium. We use dollars per member per month. We charge $9.66 per member per month. That works out to roughly 2.9% of premium. So going forward, if we stay on the federal platform and we do nothing differently about what we're doing here in Oregon, that would be about 6% of premium. The federal part will flow, as it's proposed right now, from carriers to the federal government, so it won't be subject to the statutory 5% maximum, but it'll be more than 5%, and I think we're cognizant of that, and that's a lot to pay for the overall system. And so at a minimum going forward, we're going to need to do something different in how we behave, and we need to be able to lay out for you all what we think the different options are and choices of what we want our state-based marketplace to look like going forward. Well, in order to do that, one of the steps that we've taken that's got some press, and I alluded to it a little bit when I was here in November, is we've done a request for proposal for platform technology. Two elements to that. One is the small business element called SHOP, which we need to do in any case, and the other is an individual platform. And, of course, the headline generally is there they go again, but this time they really promise it'll work, and, you know, variations on that kind of a theme. It's important to me that you understand what we're really doing at its fundamental level is basic due diligence. Before I can come back here and tell you that the $13 to $15 million a year we would send the federal government collectively as a system for their platform is a good deal, I feel like I need to have some kind of an idea of what would the private marketplace be willing to provide if what we're asking for this time is proven technology that's in effect in other states and is something that can be put up and running in its more or less existing form as distinguished from hiring a software company to go build you a system. Now, my expectation, a number of things could happen. Could be we don't get any bidders, certainly. My expectation is that we'll probably see technology costs that look broadly similar to what the federal government is charging, and so we'll have that policy conversation about what do we want to do in terms of the overall cost of the system. It's possible that we'll end up with some kind of a proposal, perhaps from a vendor, perhaps from another state, and we've had some high-level, brief preliminary conversations of those sorts of both kinds and some others. That is something that, if deliverable, would be an interesting policy conversation and an interesting conversation about is there a project. That's a conversation that would begin with that data point that will come in with the responses to our request for proposals at the end of this month and would ultimately culminate in our having to come to you for budget authority to spend any money to do any kind of a significant project as well as much more extensive conversations, both individual notification as required in Senate Bill 1 and through the regular committee process. So
I'm sure you're expecting some skepticism.
I have skepticism. I believe me, the very most straightforward thing to do is no project. There are trade-offs that go with no project. There are trade-offs not just in terms of cost, but also in terms of control and flexibility. Let me give you a couple of examples. On the control side, it's a small one I can talk about. There are some others that are more concerning, but I can't talk about them. You may recall that at the end of November, CMS decided to extend the deadline to sign up for coverage to have it effective January 1st by a couple of days because they had a whole lot of in. Perfectly fine decision. I would have made the same decision. They didn't ask us. They didn't tell us ahead of time. They just did it, and there was a press release first thing in the morning that good news, there's an extension, a bunch of things we probably could have done to make that more effective. But it's the point that they clearly controlled that dynamic and made that decision, and we weren't really a relevant part of it. From a flexibility standpoint, we talked at the last interim days, and we'll talk again in February about the premium assistance program you're going to consider for the COFA Islanders. While we're going to have to figure out kind of a scotch tape and baling wire way to deliver that system, because the federal platform, healthcare.gov, can't accommodate it. And in fact, you just heard from OHA about 1115 waivers. 1332 are the flavor of waivers we have in the private marketplace. The federal government just came out with guidance that said if you want a waiver and it requires anything different on healthcare.gov than what we're currently doing, your waiver will be denied because we can't change the platform. So there are some non-cost trade-offs that we'll want to talk about as well. But all that said, you'd have to be crazy to want to sign up to go do a project like that again unless there was really a compelling argument from a policy standpoint and from a cost standpoint and from a project management standpoint about why you'd want to do that. And that, I wouldn't expect to bring you anything along those lines unless it met that kind of a threshold. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So if I'm understanding this correct, when the federal government or CMS starts to charge for the portal, you're looking at 3.5% of the premium.
3%.
3% mm-hmm. of the premium. And the cost to Oregon now, you said, is 2.9% of what they're doing to kind of work with the system?
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden. Again, we don't denominate it as 2.9, so that's kind of a ballpark given how we do it. But, yeah, that's everything about plan management, certification, contracting with carriers, all of the outreach that we do, everything about running a state-based marketplace, we pay for with that $9.66. If we stay with the federal platform and we don't want to have a combined cost that's in the neighborhood of 6%, we're going to have a conversation about what do you want us to do in terms of how we operate the program and what are the trade-offs in terms of effectiveness and control.
So because we're staying with this quasi-state-based system and not fully using the portal, that's because we're doubling it. That's why we're doubling up?
Close. It's because we're using the federal portal and not our own portal. The management, we're fully utilizing the portal. We're not having the federal government manage the relationship with the insurers, and we're not relying on the thin amount of outreach the federal government does through mass media and not the detailed stuff that we're doing on the ground in Oregon.
But other states use the federal portal system, and the federal government does manage that portion of it, or
yes,
all states?
That's correct. So when we talk about being the third highest state in the country for increase in enrollment and the second highest for percentage of eligible insured, the states that are way lower than us are the ones that are relying on the federal government 100% for their program.
So then why do we have to pay the full 3%?
Well, that's a great question, and we've raised that in our commentary to HHS, and I'm sure they'll be right on that for us.
We'll send one of those things to Congress that you love.
That's right. Let's pass a resolution. Yeah, that would be great.
They're so effective.
They work just great. You mentioned the agents, and I know I was pretty outspoken at the beginning about trying to pay the agents in a different way that they're used. They have been very effective, there's no question about it. They add overhead as well, though. It comes in a different form, right?
Yeah, the agent commissions are paid by the carriers, and so they basically work into the rates in terms of the administrative costs that carriers have for rates. There are some issues that I'm interested in exploring more about the agent relationship with carriers. Commissions vary from carrier to carrier. The processes vary in their detail and in their transparency of how you get to be an agent for a carrier, some of those kinds of things. I think we want to spend some time learning more about that and seeing if that system, and of course the way it works today is different than it worked when Cover Oregon existed, because there was a master agent relationship and between Cover Oregon and the carriers, and individual agents were effectively sub agents for Cover Oregon. So we need to spend some time between now and next year looking at that issue.
That'd be a very good thing to do. It seems to me there are far more efficient ways to deal with that situation than we deal with them now.
I agree.
Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. So do we, the state, have any way to know, so those people that aren't purchasing, that are subject to the fine, so I'm trying to understand the marketplace out there, so do we have any idea who those people are or how many of those people are?
We do, Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively. In a couple of ways, we... After open enrollment is done, we'll have some, and 6 months after it's done, so some time for reconciling data and those kinds of things, we'll have some pretty detailed information about who is in the system and what they look like. And we'll have some fairly gross level information about who's not in the system.
Okay.
What we did in preparation for the small bore marketing and outreach that we're doing now was some fairly extensive market research through surveys and other means to learn more about those populations. We identified, for instance, six high target counties that we particularly wanted to aim our outreach at, which were a mix of urban and rural counties, particular populations where we knew we had to do work. And I would expect that we would again do that and try to figure out where's the best place to expend resources, should we decide there will be any, to make that next lift.
Thanks.
Is Deanne Gilmer with you now?
She is.
Okay.
Would you
want to join the boss and talk about the waiver?
And
VLC, yeah.
Kenny Geyer has.
Okay, while she's coming.
She's coming. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Allen. This is really overall a fabulous report. You've
thank
done
you.
A lot with very little. It's really refreshing news. I'm curious about the breakdown by federal poverty level on page 36. And because of my work on the basic health plan, I'm wondering if you could, right now, it has 100 to 150% of FPL is at 11.2. And I'm curious why you would use that that breakdown as opposed to 133 or 138% to 150, because we're really trying to figure out above the Medicaid population up to 200, what percent are buying into the marketplace and what percent aren't. So that's just a key measure. And so it would be more helpful if it was broken down that way. So I can't quite tell exactly for that population what it is, but it's somewhere between the 30% and the 41.2%, if you combine those two categories. But also just, what would your, it was very helpful when you said on the young people that you're capturing about 25%, you didn't say what your target rate was for that. I'd be curious about that. But, and I'd also be curious what your target rate would be for this population if we weren't to do the basic health plan and to stick with this.
Sure, let me, before I turn it over to Dan, let me, Chair Greenlick, Representative Kinnegar, that 25% figure is of those insured, about 25% are 18 to 34. I don't know that we have a target other than a general rule of thumb is about 30% is considered the
more
most
the
desirable.
Yeah,
yeah, the more the better.
More
but
the
30%
better.
Is considered the most desirable yeah. number. But there were, you know, the number where you start becoming concerned about being in a cost death spiral are considerably lower than that 25%.
Okay.
So we're certainly in the operative range. Dan, you want to take
that? Yes, another excellent question, Chair Greenlick.
Please
and Representative
yourself.
Kenny Geyer. Regarding...
Please introduce
oh,
yourself.
I'm sorry, yes. Deanne Gilmore, and I work with the Marketplace at Department of Consumer and Business Services. The reason that it's divided in that way is that's the way that CMS provided the data for this last year. There was a lot of unhappiness about that in Medicaid expansion states because we had no way of knowing between 138 and 150%.
Right.
And so this year we believe we're going to get a more refined information that will allow us to take a look at between 138 and 150 and from 150 to 200. The reason they did it in that way had to do with the cost share reduction. So it made sense from their perspective, but a number of states pointed out exactly that problem.
Thank you.
Do you have an estimate of the number between 138 and 200% in the marketplace?
Right now, we know up. We know below. I should say no. I'll have to get back to
it's
you.
It's between 30 and 41.2.
Yes.
That's one column plus two.
Exactly.
The difference between one column and two columns together. One is 11.2 is the 100 to 150, which is the part you can't break down, and then it's 30% in the column of 150 to 200.
35%.
Yeah, maybe 35.
So, Mr. Chair, would you like us to switch to LC 130 and the basic health?
That's right. We're opening up a discussion on LC 130. And there's a couple of pieces to it. Would you?
Yeah, we'd be happy to comment briefly and then see if there are questions that you might have. Of course, there's been an extensive task force working on basic health plan, as you know. They've issued a report, and LC 130 is a concept to implement that report. We're, of course, supportive of pursuing a 1332 waiver to accomplish the goals of that report. We've got a little bit of sort of as-drafted concern. As drafted, it really is calling for us to do basic health plan TM, if you will, as a defined term under federal law, with particularly a set of specific features that we believe were more recommendations to consider from the task force. Our concern simply is that we think that what should be articulated in the bill is for us to bring you back a blueprint that accomplishes the objectives of the basic health plan without necessarily tying us into bringing you specifically a blueprint for a federally qualified basic health plan, because we have grave concerns, particularly given the 1332 waiver guidance that just came out that requires waivers to be budget neutral, not debt deficit neutral, meaning there can't be cross-subsidy across programs. We don't want to bring you back something that is fiscally very difficult, if not impossible, to be able to implement. We want to bring you back something that we think can be accomplished and can deliver the spirit of what the task force is looking for. Also, smaller point, we'd hope that LC-130 could be amended when it gets introduced in bill form to provide some clear guidance that, aside from the basic health plan, we're going to consolidate the other waiver conversations that are floating around out there into a single conversation with a single set of recommendations back to you. We've had some conversations very briefly with a number of the stakeholders involved in the effort, and our intent would be to sit down with them between now and the start of session in February to come up with a consensus amendment that would take care of those kinds of issues. Dan, anything to add?
That'd be great if you work with the LC on having that available as early as possible. They won't do anything until the bill gets drafted. I mean, it's all formed as a bill, but it'd be very useful if you're involved in that discussion.
Because I think the only thing to add is just to have enough flexibility to explore the options which continue to change so that we can bring back a range of policy options and information and model different things and not just literally do the BHP as required under federal law and rules.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Just in broad strokes, under the 1332, my understanding is that waiver is to stay budget neutral. If we look at the presentation, also to at least increase or have better access to health care. How do you stay budget neutral, go to 200% of the poverty level, and maintain coverage levels for this population without dropping adult dental or any other particular? How do you do that?
Yeah, Dan, do you want to speak to that?
Without dropping it, well, adult dental would be one
thing. Or mental health services or whatever the service may be.
Right. Well, and that's part of what I think exploring and going back again with an analysis similar to what Wakely and Urban did before, but updating it with the new assumptions. One of the things that that was different that came out of the BHP work group that was exceedingly helpful was providers coming forward with an option to have a reduced provider payment. It still doesn't pencil out to no deficit. It still has some problems, but there are various things that have changed since 2014 that make it at least possible to consider, and also we'll see additional guidance coming through from the federal government about what constitutes the baseline that you need to be neutral to. So at this point, we're going to learn more from them in the months ahead, too.
And you want to add to something?
Well, you've got other folks, sir.
Oh, other folks on the...
If there are no other questions for us, we'd be happy to vacate the space.
Yeah, if you would just give us a little on the consolidation of the 1332 waivers.
Sure.
What it is we're trying to do here.
Yeah, sure. So in addition, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, in addition to the basic health plan issue, there are a number of conversations out there that we're aware of in some degree of detail from lots to nothing more than a rumor. And a lot of them are similar to the COFA discussion of particular targeted populations or challenges. The family glitch is an easy one to explain. It's the issue of what happens if an employee is offered coverage, but the coverage for their family members is quite poor. They're basically locked out of the marketplace. How might you address that? Those kinds of things. Rather than have you all approached, I think I counted up at one point about a dozen of those that were out there. Rather than you all have to manage a dozen of those individual policy conversations and run air traffic control yourselves over any potential interrelationships, whether they qualify for waivers with the new guidance, all those kinds of things, we think it would be best for us to consolidate those into a single 1332 conversation where we vet all those issues, look at their interrelationships, look at how they comport with the guidance, and then bring you back recommendations of the waivers we think we should pursue as a single package of answers rather than a lot of one-off conversations.
I think that would be very helpful. We haven't heard anything any problems from other agencies. We may yet, but I sense you're working behind the scenes on this.
We are.
Okay, let's get a couple more folks to join. Ms. Gilman, why don't you hang in for a minute?
Who? Who did you want to hang in?
Dan.
Oh, well, why don't you hang in for a minute? Let me ask Janet Bauer and Martin Taylor to join for brief comments on LC, LC-130.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, this is Martin Taylor. I'm representing Care Oregon and the CCOs affiliated by Care Oregon, with Care Oregon. So just to clarify your interest, we are, Jan and I are, signed up to testify later. Do you want us to do all of that?
This is the testimony that you're signed up for on LC-30. Okay. I pulled LC-130 up.
Okay.
In advance, so if you would give your testimony now, that would be great.
Sure. Just clarifying, and if I could just do one thing first, which is I heard really positive suggestions from Patrick Allen at DCBS, and I think those are things that we're likely to incorporate into the as amendments. I don't see a lot of tension there. And we're not dropping adult dental in the marketplace. The population between 138 and 200% currently doesn't have that benefit. So your question really is, can we find the money to add it? Which everybody in the work group supported, but we were given the parameter of bringing something that was budget neutral. So it's budget neutral with every encouragement for you to find the money. So I'll start our testimony. Thanks.
That's
good. So I really was, for a moment, want to recapture the Care Oregon experience. We have watched the basic health plan conversation from a very interested gallery for a while, because we know that by definition the basic health plan is an advantageous plan for consumers. In order to have a basic health plan policy, the federal government requires the benefit to be as good or better, the cost to the consumer to be less, and for them to have choice. So it always made sense from an advocacy standpoint. We advocate for our members. We believe our members would have a benefit from the basic health plan. What we didn't know is whether or not it could work. Would it pencil out? So just as an insurance company, we couldn't say, yes, go do this. We needed to have a work group and go through the process of figuring out, would the benefit package, would the cost to consumers, would the provider rates, would all of those things pencil out to be a viable package, particularly knowing that the legislature was looking for something that was budget neutral. I can tell you that Care Oregon, through the work group process, can now support this proposal. And I want to just give you three really clear criteria for why. The first criteria is we shouldn't do something just because the industry stakeholders feel like it's to their advantage. We should do something because it's to the advantage of those consumers. Consumers gain the benefit not only of having something that's got to be as good or better product and price with choice, but they also have increased continuity with plans that they see in Medicaid, and this is a population that moves back and forth from Medicaid a lot. So there's greater continuity with their providers and the systems of care they're used to. And we capture about 6,000 folks who are not currently able to be insured through the exchange. So there's some solid consumer advantages. The second criteria is really a criteria about public policy. So between 2008 and 2011, I was very active with all of you in trying to figure out what Oregon's approach to health care reform would be. And I would remind all of us that we went before the federal government and the ACA doing some tremendous Medicaid reforms based on some solid principles, some of which were picked up in the ACA and Medicaid. Our Medicaid reform is something that states across the country try to replicate. And it's because we have increased transparency. We have much better accountability for plans in other states. We pay plans incentives for hitting certain quality measures, which is unusual. We're also a state that increasingly puts transformation funds into ways where plans and providers can create alternative payment methods that create more capitation and shared risk. It's still new. It's not perfect. But that model we call the coordinated care model. You think of it mostly as CCOs and Medicaid as certain plans, but the fact is that it is now a model of care, not just in this state, but other states are replicating it. We've replicated in PEB. We're trying it in OEB. And this is an opportunity to expand a model of your creation to this population that's 138 and 200%, to between 138 and 200% of poverty. So the third thing as criteria was the do no harm criteria. And we really heard this specifically from the representatives that talked in the committee, Representative Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer. It was, we need this to be budget neutral. So we penciled that out. We had three hydraulics we worked with to get there, which was the benefit plan, the provider rates, and how much consumers would pay. And it was based on old data. It was a Wakely report using 2013 data. But we all knew that this is going to take at least 2 years before we would implement. So no matter what we did with more current numbers, you are going to have to shoot those numbers again in 2018. The important point is you have the levers to make something that's budget neutral, and you will have those levers in 2018. The number, the exact plan might shift a little bit based on current market conditions, but the levers exist to have a budget neutral proposal. So then the next question was, how do we do this without harming the marketplace? So it was really helpful that we had Deanne there with us to give us some context of what the marketplace needed and didn't need. But the thing that none of us expected when the work group started, that was the product of the work group, is let's actually offer the basic health plan on the marketplace. Now, offering it on the marketplace actually is not only a way of maybe stabilizing the or making sure the marketplace isn't destabilized, there's some really important questions for you as policymakers and for DCBS and the marketplace to explore about, can this in fact become a market stabilizer? So I'm beginning to get outside of my knowledge belt, but I'm gonna put three questions in front of you and for DCBS to consider. The first question is, we expanded through the ACA, people 100 to 138% of poverty, and the plans that saw those folks made a lot of money last year. Between 138% of poverty and 200% of poverty, we put folks on the exchange. That's the basic health plan eligible population. And the individual market in the exchange became pretty toxic. You know, big players, the Motas, the Pacific Sources, lost a lot of money last year in the individual market. So why the difference between people between 100 and 133% or 133, 138, and 200% of poverty? Answering that question will give you a lot of information about how to stabilize the individual market that's getting clobbered. Second question. We move, I think, even in these conversations today, between basic health plan as a specific policy and a 1332 waiver. In a 1332 waiver, though, you may be able to create a product that actually allows you to grow the participation of people in that belt in the insurance market for a variety of reasons. The better cost sharing, the better benefit, the fact you've got more bodies coming in, but also just the continuity they have to their existing Medicaid plans, so they're changing less often. So is there some advantage in simply growing the number of lower risk people that are entering the individual market using this as a tactic? And third, could this work group report that basically describes how to expand the coordinated care model into the marketplace actually be a marketplace solution and not just for the 138 to 200% of poverty? Is the same principles that we're talking about for that population actually relevant to anybody that's buying their health insurance through the marketplace? So I present you those three questions. The last thing I'd like to do is just really acknowledge that that was a great work group and a great OHA staff that provided it, and we really got a lot of guidance from the representatives, particularly Representative Kenny Geyer, that came to all the meetings. We really appreciate the fact that we were given an opportunity to explore this, because this is an area of policy that I think for a lot of the healthcare stakeholders that weren't in the work group is still very new, and we have a much better explanation of something complicated than we did before that work group. So thanks for that bill last session.
We'll have a more detailed debate. Yeah. On the committee, in the committee when the bill comes to us, but some introduction.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Martin covered a lot of ground. I don't know that there's a lot more for me to add. I was going to kind of step you through some of the details of the LC. What I think could be helpful, given the fact that we're in agreement that there are some amendments in order that would provide some fixes that would help strengthen Oregon's ability to make sure all of the components add up correctly. Especially in light of the fact that we're going to need to get some new estimates of those federal numbers, that does make sense. But I do want to say that the bill outlines a couple things that we believe are important. One is the benefit package being
having continuity with the Oregon Health Plan. Secondly, that there would be a sustainable rate of growth assumed in the plans, and that, as Martin mentioned, that we would be promulgating the CCO model, and that regardless of who was offering the plans in the marketplace, whether that's a CCO or whether that's another commercial carrier, that it would be an expansion of the model in Oregon, essentially in our private market. So the task of the bill is to charge DCBS with crafting a blueprint, which is the formality of making the application to the federal government, to do that under advisement with stakeholders, to bring that back to you before the end of this year for review, and in 2017 before any submission, so that you are comfortable and in agreement with the proposals that we have, and as Dan suggested, there may be some options that we still may have at that point. So we look forward to working with the agency on making these tweaks to the current bill, and are sure that we can come up with something that would conform with, I think, which is our common vision of assuring better coverage and promoting health reform in the marketplace, and doing a better job of assuring that individuals get the care that they need, particularly those who are most vulnerable. So we're happy to take questions. Really, thank you for the opportunity to highlight what's going on in this particular
LC. And you'll keep working with DCBS to deal with those amendments. Say we can facilitate that work on the amendments for the LC 31. That would be very useful.
So, sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to stand at ease for a moment, please.
It's really slow now.
Okay.
Back in order. The item on the agenda that we skipped over that we need to come back to now is the question of mental health integration. OHA is going to talk about that.
She went to get the director.
Went to get her. Hold on. Sorry to confuse your schedule, Lynn. We're back at that part of the agenda where we're going to talk about mental health integration and the
Perfect.
CCOs.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Then
we'll let you go.
Chair Greenlick and committee members, that would be great. Thank you. As you know, we have been working throughout the last year to produce what we like to call the Foundation for Behavioral Health Integration and Improvement in the state of Oregon. And let me just tell you the moving parts of that, and then I'd like to specifically touch on the behavioral health town halls that we recently completed. In February of last year, we began to build what is called a behavioral health mapping tool, which is mapping resources, outcomes, and programs across the state by key demographic groups. That tool has had two oversight meetings by a technical advisory committee comprised of people in the behavioral health field in terms of data analytics and research. So they are excited about the tool, and we will be completing it this year. Secondly, we have been we went on a behavioral health town hall meeting tour around the state. It was my privilege to attend all of those meetings with Senator Gelser, and we wrapped up that tour with a virtual town hall, which was cool. So let me just walk you through what that experience was, and then you'll be seeing this report in February legislative days.
This is in relation to CCO integration?
That's
the topic today.
Yes. 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 We're going to connect the dots.
Connect them.
Okay. Yeah. So these were the sites of our visits with people who are users in the system, and part of that effort was to get their experience of the behavioral health system as it currently exists. As you know, some people in Oregon's behavioral health system are served by CCOs, and we got some great ideas, suggestions, criticisms, compliments from members and users of the system on how that part of the system is working, and we also got some great comments and feedback on how community mental health program and county mental health program services are being experienced by members. There were, we used a different format for the discussions, and we had a facilitator who's a professional facilitator. But part of what we wanted to do was not drive people to a foregone conclusion, but open up a very honest and frank conversation with them about what was working, what is working for them, what their priorities are, and what is not working. And we were pleased to have significant CCO participation in those meetings. I'll take full responsibility for this. We did ask providers and CCOs to sit separately from the members and users of the system, because the members and users of the system expressed to us that they wanted to be sure to be able to express their opinions without feeling any pressure. And initially that kind of people were a little anxious about that, but as the town halls convened, I think the CCOs, the providers, and the members got very used to that format and were productive. At the end of the day, it produced some very interesting comments about things that are important to people, like, as no surprise to any of us, housing, employment, and particularly and heart-wrenchingly, the importance of people in Oregon's behavioral health system to have natural supports in their lives and socialization.
I'm sorry, I'm getting a little impatient with this.
Okay.
The question was, can you tell us what's going on in the CCO integration of mental health services and CCOs? We expect in the 2017 session to take a whole look at the question of the mental health system.
So you want? We may have misunderstood your inquiry. We had understood that you wanted to know the behavioral health system transformation work that we're about to undergo. But you are specifically asking how CCOs are doing with integration today?
Yes, that's specifically the question we asked.
Okay.
How are they doing, and what are you doing in relation to them to facilitate the integration of mental health services in CCOs?
Okay. So, specifically, we can set this aside. We are going to bring this forward.
It's very important work. I don't want to denigrate what you're saying. I
got it.
Joined you in one of them. I loved it. It was really quite amazing to hear things. I think it's going to be very important for us. But
okay.
Today, the CCO question, because we're getting a lot of pressure on that question.
Yes. So specifically on the integration of behavioral health and CCOs today, we have one metric right now with the CCOs. We actually have several that gives us a good read on that. And so one of the concerns we have right now that we are addressing through this process and our other processes is we know where behavioral health integration is occurring in the CCOs, and most frequently it's occurring in patient-centered primary care homes, and we can give you the data on the increase in patient-centered primary care homes. We also can give you a summary of the various CCOs that have initiatives beyond patient-centered primary care homes, and the behavioral health integration is occurring specifically in those CCOs. So what may be a better use of your time is for us to go back and compile that information, and we can bring it back to you. I don't have it with me today.
I think it would be very helpful to have.
Yep. So we can do that. I think one of the things I want to underscore is Jeremy Vandehay and I, the governor's chief of staff, and I are touring with the CCOs. We've toured, I think, 4 to date, and we'll be completing all 16 before, I think, March 8th. In that process, we're getting additional data from them on their behavioral health integration efforts. So, for example, I can share with you an excellent presentation we had from Willamette Valley CCO that talks about what's currently happening, psychologists, psychiatrists, interventions beyond patient-centered primary care homes. So we can bring that information back to you.
There is the feeling that there is not a whole lot happening in this area, that this is a big area, of problems. So if you have a sense it is not the case, that would be helpful for us to know. But if it is the case, the question is, what are you all doing to...
So with Chair Greenlick, with your indulgence, I just want to touch on one thing. Is we have been told, and I have been told consistently and over the course of the last year, that more integration can and must occur. We believe that to be true, and this effort, as well as the mapping effort and the work we're doing with the U.S. Department of Justice, is to lay a data set for that work so that we are able to have a process with the CCOs where we advance behavioral health integration. So the work is, the homework has been being done throughout the last year. The work going forward, I have a document due to the governor in January about a process for advancing behavioral health integration. And the third cornerstone of that work is the U.S. Department of Justice agreement, which we are in the final stages of development. So I want to be really clear here. There's a lot of assertions that the CCOs can do more. I think they would be the first in line to say, yes, we can do more, and we're planning to do more. The Oregon Health Authority has been spending the last year setting the table, if you will, for convening that conversation. And I want to underscore that conversation has to include our county partners because of the number of people who are served in the mental health system who are not in CCOs. They are served by our services, and they are served by the counties. So,
yeah, and that's a part of the problem.
Yes. Yes, and that's part of why we're doing this research, to be prepared to have that conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Question. Okay, we have two.
Pardon me?
We have two. Kenny Guy right here.
Let's go first. Mine's easy, I think.
And mine's really quick. It's not even a question. It's just, I want to give a shout out to the youth suicide prevention plan that was just released, I think, a couple days ago out of your office, out of OHA. It was a bill that Senator Gilser had carried a couple of years ago. That plan had not been updated in 20 years. It created a new position. And what I have been hearing just in the last 48 hours is incredible kudos. So that is another piece that will be used statewide that
Absolutely.
You're doing to support the efforts out there. So just wanted to call that out. It's great
Thank
work.
You. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, mine was more, what is this Department of Justice issue? We got briefed on this before, I don't remember what it was.
No, we actually haven't had full briefing on this yet. Why don't you comment on that a bit?
Sure. The state of Oregon has been working with the U.S. Department of Justice for 3 years on their expectations for our behavioral health system. They have, as you know, the state hospital is funded entirely by general fund dollars, and the U.S. Department of Justice is candidly and frankly not a fan of institutionalization. And so we've been in negotiations with them, begun by previous Governor Kitzhaber, to get to an agreement about how fast Oregon can change its behavioral health system to meet U.S. Department of Justice expectations.
And keeping people at the least restrictive environment.
Yes, yes.
Is the underlying issue.
So we're well into that work. We expect to have the agreement in January. Part of what we've done over the course of the last 7 months is use the data from the behavioral health mapping tool and our own research to kind of negotiate how we can improve the system over the course of the next 3 years. So, and the reason why this is opportune to have all these things happening at one time is because of the discussion that Chair Greenlick mentioned. There is concern that we are not integrating behavioral health at the CCO level as much as we would like to or need to. And again, we wanted to have those three pieces in place that I've described so that we can begin that work.
Okay. Well, maybe at a future meeting we could.
Oh, we're
going to
be talking about
this. It'd be interesting to hear about.
Absolutely.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick, thank you.
thank you for the work on this. It's very important. I think that mental health transformation in Oregon is really a very big need in Oregon, if not our biggest need in Oregon. So I'm very interested in looking at that table when you get it set, you know, the mapping of where the funds and the providing the services. When you take the CCO population separately from the general population, what percentage or roughly what percentage of mental health services are currently provided through the CCO now versus what's provided through the state or through the counties? How much are they doing acute and chronic care currently?
So the county, it depends on the county.
Yes.
It depends on the CCO.
Yes.
But roughly, I would guess it's 3/4 is done by the CCOs, given the level of enrollment we have. But that's part of the reason for the behavioral health mapping tool is when we first looked at that data last February, we were not pleased with how accurate we thought it was. So the work is underway to get specific answers to
your
questions.
But that's three quarters of the services for the medically indigent population. I mean, that's not talking about the whole private health care.
That's right. That's not counting the private health care.
That's still three-quarters of – that's a million people on our health plan. Three-quarters of those.
So we're
– and is it fair to ask, and it may not be fair to ask yet, of that three-quarters percent, is that portion working pretty good for that population?
Well, that's completely unknown. That three-quarters is the mental health – it's a piece of the state mental health dollars that went to caring for indigent mental health services. And we founded that whole notion, as Mr. Taylor said a few moments ago, on the basis of being an integrated mental health and dental health services. It's going about as well as the dental health is doing. How's that doing?
Okay. Well, that's why I say we have a need here.
I think there is a suspicion that in most places that integration is not going very well. I think that's what we need to find out, the extent to which that's...
Yes. Chair Greenlick, and I think, again, I want to point to the research we're doing, because when we look, we can look at a behavioral health resource map for every county in the state of Oregon. We produced that during the 2015 legislature. It was a draft. We sat down with legislators and looked at their particular counties, and they said, no, that's not right. We have this, and you're not showing that we have this percentage of that service. So the advisory committee is the data geeks, and with all due respect, to are going through and saying, nope, you need to get this source of data, you need to get that funding identified so that we can have a clear picture for decision making. I don't have that today. I had lots of discussions about what was wrong and whose fault it was and who should get more money. That tool is going to help us have that discussion and that resource allocation made based on data as opposed to supposition. I will tell you, I just want to give it, I think it's really important to give credit where credit is due. And the CCOs in the first 2 years of starting up this system had a lot to take on. And the metrics that we established by collective and stakeholder engagement really focused on the highest priorities of physical health. And that probably was the right thing to do, because those are the biggest savings and the quickest gains. I think in all of my discussions with the CCOs, they have all expressed their enthusiasm for integrating behavioral health and oral health more successfully. I have to say, there isn't one that hasn't said, we're looking forward to doing this work better as we go forward. So I think phase one went well. We got some gains. We met our targets to the federal government. We are still, I want to underscore, Oregon is still the envy of the country for the coordinated care model. We're not going as fast as all of us in this room want to go, but we're going faster than most other states, and that's to be applauded. Doesn't mean we rest on our laurels. There's a huge amount of work to do, but I do want to underscore that the CCOs have universally said, we're ready, we're interested in the discussion, we're really excited to have the counties at the table. We're really excited to have the state hospital at the table, because that's part of the rub point, is that we have people going to the state hospital who should be in community services.
I think let's go on. If you have more information for us.
Nope. We'll send you what would be a reasonable timeline for you.
A reasonable timeline would be to get information that we know is valid and really addresses the question. less of the time you need it. If I'm counting correctly, we're in the fourth year of five-year contracts for the CCO.
Right.
And it's about time we had some sense about how this mental health issue is going. We're going to go on.
Okay. We will get back to you with the schedule for the behavioral health mapping tool because that's going to be the best data.
I want data specifically about what the CCOs are doing. If you have that data, get it for us. If you don't, tell us you don't know. It's perfectly okay for you to say we don't know.
Okay. We'll give you what we've got, and we'll tell you when we'll have better.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to the LCs. We're going to have two more brief hearings on two other LCs, then we're going to move the three committee LCs, and then we'll have some more discussion about individual LCs that might get to the committee. So let me, we have a brief panel on LC 128. There are four of you listed. That'd be great. Take about a minute and a half each or something. Two at a time would be perfect. You can take 3 minutes each for your first two.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paul Cosgrove representing the National Association of Vision Care Plans. I can be quicker than that. One comment, my comments are directed to the bill as it's intended to be. That we found one issue in the draft that'll need to be corrected. So I'm going to comment as we expect it to be. This bill does two things. One, it restores a policy on optical labs. It's especially important for vertically integrated health insurers and those who have preferred provider-type relationships. That was in the bill on this subject that left this committee, and I think that bill left this committee unanimously last session, but was removed by the Senate on the Senate side. So it restores that provision. And the second thing it does is it restores parity between insurers and non-insurance entities on voluntary discounts given for services and products that aren't necessarily covered by insurance. The Senate added a provision after the bill left here allowing those voluntary discount programs. That means it is a voluntary agreement between the provider and, in that case, a non-insurance discount card entity. We're asking for the same thing of the ability to have a voluntary agreement between the provider and an insurance vision care insurance provider to allow discounts on those products and services. Those discounts are particularly important to a whole lot of Oregonians, and the bill is effective that you passed last year is effective January 1, but of course it doesn't affect contracts that people have with various employers and employer groups until those contracts renew. And some of those contracts that will be affected with lots of those discounts are the contracts from the Teamsters and from UFCW. There are a number of other unions. And frankly, all PEB enrollees will also be affected by that because they have a vision care provider that currently provides those discounts that when that contract rolls will not be able to be part of it. So those are the two things that the bill addresses. It does not reopen and readdress all of the issues in the vision care bill last session, just these two. And once again, it's restoring the provision on labs that you, as the bill left here, back into the law, and giving that parity between insurance-based and non-insurance-based voluntary discount programs. So I'd be glad to answer any questions if there are any.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We're here to just echo Mr. Cosgrove's comments and say that we think that this bill makes two important changes to the law that passed last session. We believe that this begins to kind of restore some of the important relationships between providers and insurers. We have that important tension on the medical side. We think that by fixing these couple of issues that we enable consumers to benefit from those negotiations. So we would encourage swift consideration of this bill once the session opens.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You want to move in or quick question?
Yeah.
Time?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Could you explain to me how you put a voluntary clause within a provider contractual agreement?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it is a clause that it can be added to an agreement or not added at the choice of the provider. In other words, providers can sign up to have this additional thing. Many providers like that ability because it's an additional marketing. If you think of it, the typical case is the second pair of glasses that might not be covered under the insurance coverage, and providers will be able to sell a second pair of glasses if they have perhaps a marketing tool of a discount. And if they choose to have that, we have those programs. They can sign up for those discounts. Under the law that was passed as amended by the Senate, those are not permitted, even if both the provider and the insurer want to do that.
If that person is insured through that insurance, if they're not insured through it, they could currently have the discounts for them.
There are, just like there are non-insurance-related discounts for motels, hotels, restaurants, all those kinds of things, there are non-insurance discount cards for vision care services that are currently allowed on a voluntary basis. We just want to have that same ability to negotiate those on a voluntary basis with providers if we're an insurance company. It'd be the provider's choice whether to do it or not. And if they thought it was a good marketing, just like the non-insurance discount cards might be something we want to do as a good marketing plan for their business. They could do it or not do it.
Representative Nunes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does this bill undo what we passed in the last session where it allows an optometrist to sort of choose the lens crafter, lens maker that they want? If they, is that what this essentially does? Like, instead they have to go with a lens crafter that the insurance plan wants them to use?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it allows, in certain insurance plans, there are actually labs that are owned by the insurer, and in those, the insured benefit, it's not that you can't choose somewhere else, but the insured benefit is with the insurer's lab. There's at least one example of that. In other insurance plans, there are effectively preferred provider type relationships with certain labs. And again, the optometrist can choose any lab. It just may not be, it'll be out of network effectively. That's not quite the right way to say it, because that's a concept in medical plans. But it doesn't restrict use. It restricts what we're going to cover.
Okay. We have two more witnesses on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You please call.
Oh, sure. Ashley McFerrin and Nikki Terziev.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We will also be brief and honor the request. And in the same vein, you know, we believe this bill does two things. It repeals the ability for the physician and the patient to decide what's going to be the best option for them, and it repeals the ability for an optometric physician to continue to serve their full book of patients with convenience and cost effectiveness. The idea of a voluntary provision in a contract is this is not a liken to AAA, IMED or VSP. Those big plans are not like AAA or AARP. They have a significant portion of market control. But to speak more adeptly to it is our optometrist, Dr. McFerrin.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlook, members of the committee. Dr. Ashley McFerrin, I have a practice in Canby, and I'm also the president-elect of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. LC 128 attempts to unravel these protections after being in effect for only 13 days, and there's no evidence that this new law is not working as it was intended, as it was passed by the Legislative Assembly. The three main components I see is that it forces participation in one vision plan in order to participate in another plan. This, again, participating in all these plans might not be the best for the patient or for my practice. Secondly, in regards to the labs and materials, it forces us to send our spectacle jobs to potentially these insurance-owned labs. And me personally, some optometrists have labs in their own offices, and so it really affects them. I personally do not, but I would prefer and have preferred for the past 5 years to do business with a lab in Portland. They, due to their quality, the speed I get the job back for the patient, their customer service, and now before HB 3530, I was forced to send things out of state. And as you guys know, this affects jobs and small businesses. So, and then in regards to the voluntary option of giving discounts on non-reimbursed services, this what we're hearing in other states that's happening is that they're sending out they'll have these preferred provider lists, or then they're sending out emails listing providers that decide not to volunteer for these this voluntary discount. So in my view, that's kind of a false choice. It's kind of tying our hands behind our back. If you don't do this voluntary discount, then you're not going to be on this list, or we're not going to send patients your way or whatever. So anyway, HB 3530 was critical in leveling the playing field and addressing the abuses that doctors and patients had been experiencing for many years. LC 128 would repeal hard-fought advances in patient access, protections, and choice. Organ jobs will be affected, small businesses will suffer, including mine. Unfair business practices by large national for-profit vision plan insurance entities will be allowed to diminish the ability of organ optometric physicians to provide optimal care for patients and communities across Oregon. I respectfully ask you to oppose LC 128. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. Happy to answer questions.
Chair Greenlick, thank you. On these plans, do the insurance companies provide you an in-state option, meaning that if you have their client and you're taking care of them, and if they were able to require you to go to a certain lab, do they always guarantee that there's a lab in your state?
Yep.
And so could you have any guess on if this took place, how much of that interaction? You say you have a lab in Portland, which is in-state, of that business would go out of state. Does your association have any idea what the economic impact would be?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, it varies by practice for sure, depending on what percentage of your practice accepts a certain or has amount of insurance that they accept. My practice personally, it's 30-40% have been taken out of Portland to a state in, or a lab in Washington, actually.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, there's a there's a lab in Eugene, which was the lab, the constituent lab, which the initial bill 3530 was introduced for, and they saw an increase from 40% to 70% of the jobs that were being sent out over the past, I believe, the duration we have here in the document, but it was a several-year period.
Thank you. Representative Nose?
Okay, I think I have. So my question is, if you have a VSP-insured patient, do you have to use a VSP lens crafter? Is that what essentially what this LC does?
For the way it stands now, for me, certain plans, yes, I'm required to use, because I haven't renewed my contract yet, so I'm still pre.
Right.
So certain plans, yes, I'm required to use the lab that they own.
Okay, and then if you don't, what's the consequence?
I don't get reimbursed. I mean, you... Yeah.
It's either use them or nothing.
Correct.
Coverage.
The patient.
Or
charged.
Or
the patient pays the whole bill.
Yeah. If the patient wants to get the benefit, then the optometrist needs to use the lab that the insurance company wants them to use.
The flip side is the patient loses the discount potentially, right? That's the flip side. I'm trying to understand from what happens from their perspective, but from the patient's side, then
patient loses the coverage.
Patient basically loses the coverage. Is that okay?
If they choose to use,
I have Kaiser coverage. I was an optometrist this week. You know, if I want to get my glasses filled, I got to fill the Kaiser. I can't go to the lens crafter or somewhere else. It's a similar issue for non-systems.
But I have VSP.
You have VSP. They sold it to your union on the basis of their members getting the services at a lab that they own or choose, because they have a deal there too. It's all part of the premium, right?
My guess, yeah.
All right. At this point, Representative, I'm just trying to understand how this works. Like, I feel like both of this is going a little over my head, right? Like, again, one side that really wants it and one side that really doesn't.
We're going
to
have lots of time when we get back, and I suspect this will have some debate in our committee as if and when we go forward with it.
All right. I'm just trying to understand it.
Will you help him understand?
Gladly.
Thank you very much. Let's move to the next LC, please, which is LC 129.
Correct.
And we have Kathleen Haley. You're not going to bring your wingman with you? I saw him hiding back there. You got 5 votes. You don't want to go for 4, huh?
Thank you.
Introduce yourself.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I serve as the executive director for the Oregon Medical Board, and I'm here to discuss LC 129 with you. The Oregon Health Professional Services Program is a monitoring program for healthcare licensees in the state who have substance abuse or mental health disorders. And the 4 boards that currently participate in this program are dentistry, nursing, pharmacy, and the medical board. By statute, since 2009, the Oregon Health Authority could either contract for those services or provide those services. They have been contracting with one vendor, Reliant Behavioral Health, so the administrative costs for us have been increasing, and as a result of looking at that, we're proposing that the boards together contract with that one vendor, Reliant Behavioral Health, and we believe that this will result in a savings of about $300,000 a biennium. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
You also suggested that you want an amendment to this as well. Would you just comment on that briefly?
Yes, Chair Greenlick, we do want to open it so that if other boards want to participate, they could also, and not just these, limit it to these 4 boards.
Any questions?
Are we allowed to weigh in with an opinion now or no?
You're welcome to have an opinion.
I would just like to weigh in with strong support. I've been hearing this idea for a long time. It seems like such a no-brainer, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing it to consideration.
Thank Ms. Haley for bringing it. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
My intention now is to accept the motion. I have to open a work session.
Yes.
Open a work session for the purpose of proposing legislation.
Oh, yeah,
I want to remind you all that voting for this is only to introduce the bill. It doesn't reflect your opinion on it. It doesn't. One should not infer how you will vote on it if and when it comes to the committee itself. It's just to introduce 3 committee bills, and I would like to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the following legislative concepts that be introduced as committee bills. LC 128, dated 12/11/2015. LC 129, dated 12/23/2015. And LC 130, dated January 5, 2016.
President Notes moves LC 128, dated 12/11/15, LC 129, dated 12/25/15, and LC 130, dated 1/5/16, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Representative, we have time now to discuss a few member LCs. Representative Notes, you have a couple you'd like to
do. Do you want me to do from here? Or you want to go down?
No, do it from here.
All right. So I have 2 LCs. One is LC 60. It's a bill that focuses on supplemental health insurance plans like Aflac, and defines what they are in statute. So, do you want me to go into it any more than that?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So when we legislate around health insurance, I know we didn't get to talk about it very much yesterday. When we legislate around health insurance, we end up either lumping these supplemental insurance plans in with comprehensive insurance plans, or we create carve-outs to exempt these insurance plans from various mandates and legislation that we create. And this bill attempts to define in statute what supplemental plans are, what they cover, and would carve them out from, say, comprehensive health insurance plans, and wouldn't have us put mandates on them unless we so wanted to. We legislated it actively.
Okay, you have another one?
I do. This one's a little more interesting.
Well, that was riveting.
LC64-1, here we go, requires notice from a pharmacist to a medical provider when the pharmacist wants to make a substitution, mm-hmm. or the patient is willing to make one, actually, for a prescribed biological medicine when a similar biological medicine, usually referred to as a biosimilar, is available. So I'm told this is an update to legislation that was passed in 2013 when I was not here. So most drugs that we use are chemical compounds. They're chemically synthesized. So their structure's known, they're easily copied, that's where we get generics. Biologics are more complex mixtures. For example, they could be a virus, a toxin, some blood derivative, or a protein. And unlike most prescription drugs, biological products tend to be heat sensitive and they're susceptible to microbial contamination, all sorts of things. So we don't just leave them in a prescription bottle. I think almost always you take biologic drugs in a hospital or a medical setting too. You don't self-administer them. So I'm told an example of one of these is Remicade. So biosimilars are just what they sound like. They are a biologic drug that is kind of like or similar to the other biologic drug that is already out on the market. It's not a generic, because a generic's an exact copy. It's a biosimilar. And so because it's similar and not an exact copy, patient groups and providers have asked that pharmacists would give notice to the provider when a substitution is requested or made by the patient. I think it's interesting to note that currently none of this is happening at the moment. There is not any biosimilar medication that the Food and Drug Administration has approved to be allowed to be substituted. But at the point that that happens, and we think it's coming, this will be a system in place that allows notification to happen.
Thank you.
Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah, thank you.
Get ready.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I actually have
two LCs.
Thank you for your LCs. I have one LC also, and I'll be able to catch up with Chair Greenlick on this. And this has to do with the conversation that happened earlier here. Questions about the CCO's relationship with the Oregon Health Plan with regards to reducing or increasing geographical areas that the coordinated care organizations have under specific contract, under specific zip codes, basically geographical areas. Last time we worked on something with the contracts on the 60-day notice, we were able to get that in place. This bill is very similar to that, and it has to do with when the Oregon Health Authority can kind of change the regulations within the contract, or if they can change the regulations within the contract. One of the things that we're seeing this last December and now is an RFP has come out for the CCOs to apply for area of coverage where another CCO is involved, and so that has created some unrest. I am very hopeful and encouraged that the Oregon Health Authority has offered to discuss this at more length and come to a reasonable agreement, hopefully prior to session, that the CCOs are comfortable with. But LC 82 is going to address the issue that we started to get into that was a little bit confusing there. The intent is to make sure that all the players understand what the process is, if there's a concern in their geographical area, if they can't cover that area for some reason, they want more input on it. Why they can't cover it? Why is the state saying that they can't cover that service area? So that is one of the technical aspects that I'll be working on this session.
All right. Any other members have any LCs that they think might come before the committee?
I'm keeping mine a secret.
Hmm?
I'm keeping mine a secret.
All right. And we're going to stand at ease until Chair Greenlick comes back. Do I have to gavel out for that? Okay.
Come back in order. I'd like to introduce an LC. I have copies here for the committee. of a one-pager.
Oh.
Brushing in the men's room.
We all took the opportunity to do it while you were running. Oh.
I appreciate that.
I'm always worried when you introduce me. I see you.
I'm open. In, when we started, the one pager will be up on OLIS, as will LC87. Is that right, Sandy?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
They'll both be up on OLIS.
I guess. So,
for those of you that have been waiting, with bated breath, LC87 looks at the question of what should a CCO look like for the next 5 and the next 10 years. We originally started CCOs with a 5-year contract. That contract ends in 2017. These are hot sellers, right? Hmm? I have a few more here. When we created CCOs, we created it in the context of a lot of ambiguity. We were in a 30-30 R&D split in the House. We had a group working to create the original CCO bill. Mm-hmm. We managed to pass a bill that passed 52-8 or 53-7, but part of it left a lot of ambiguity in what the nature of a CCO ought to be like. What LC87 does is create a blueprint for what CCOs should look like going forward in the next 5 years and in the 5 years after that. It deals with such questions as should a CCO be. It asserts the CCO should be made up of nonprofit community-based organizations. And it talks about how to deal with reserves. It talks about issues of what ought to be the absolute minimum criteria for success of a CCO and a few other garden variety issues. However, what it says is that the extent to which CCOs needs a change in their very nature, there should be time to do so. So it defines the nature of CCOs as something that needs to start from 2023 going forward, and asks CCOs in applying for the next 5 years to recognize what the world will look like 5 years hence, and to commit to moving in that direction, and in fact to give plans for how they would intend to move. I expect we may have a lot of debate on this
a little bit
as we go forward. And it's not an ideal bill to bring forward for a short session. But the reason that I brought it forward in this session is that I expect the RFP will be out for the second 5-year contract probably in about March of 2017. And that means if we really are going to do something about it, we probably need to do it in this short session rather than waiting to early in the 2017 session. If we end up not getting it this time, my sense is we can carry it through. We can get as close to consensus as we can. And if we want to continue it, we can move it very quickly in the 2017 session. But the ideal would be to get the legislature to really ask itself what should these beasts be like going forward? And there are all sorts of varieties right now that this discussion, this is a good time to have the discussion at this point. Any
comment?
Yes, please.
It would be good to have it this short session because I think our experience is changing the rules after the fact isn't so smooth.
It's not a great
idea.
So
let's not do that again for another 5-year contract.
It seems to me that would be very useful. Okay. Well, thank you all for your attention
to
this.
I look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, that's going to be
good. Conversation should be a good one. We are adjourned. And if anybody wants to join me as a co-sponsor.